Rob Roy, Complete. Volume 1, Chapter 1. How have I sinned, that this affliction should light so heavy on me? I have no more sons, and this no more mine own. My grand curse hang o'er his head that thus transformed thee. Dash travel? I'll send my horse to travel next. Monsieur Thomas. You have requested me, my dear friend, to bestow some of that leisure, with which Providence has blessed the decline of my life, in registering the hazards and difficulties which attended its commencement. The recollection of those adventures, as you are pleased to term them, has indeed left upon my mind a checkered and varied feeling of pleasure and of pain, mingled, I trust, with no slight gratitude and veneration to the disposer of human events, who guided my early course through much risk and labor, that the ease with which he has blessed my prolonged life might seem softer from remembrance and contrast. Neither is it possible for me to doubt, what you have often affirmed, that the incidents which befell me among a people singularly primitive in their government and manners, have something interesting and attractive for those who love to hear an old man's stories of a past age. Still, however, you must remember, that the tale told by one friend, and listened to by another, loses half its charms when committed to paper, and that the narratives to which you have attended with interest, as heard from the voice of him to whom they occurred, will appear less deserving of attention when perused in the seclusion of your study. But your greener age and robust constitution promise longer life than will, in all human probability, be the lot of your friend. Throw, then, these sheets into some secret drawer of your escritoire till we are separated from each other's society by an event which may happen at any moment, and which must happen within the course of a very few years. When we are parted in this world, to meet, I hope, in a better, you will, I am well aware, cherish more than it deserves the memory of your departed friend, and will find in those details which I am now to commit to paper, matter for melancholy, but not unpleasing reflection. Others bequeath to the confidants of their bosom portraits of their external features. I put into your hands a faithful transcript of my thoughts and feelings, of my virtues and of my failings, with the assured hope, that the follies and headstrong impetuosity of my youth will meet the same kind construction and forgiveness which have so often attended the faults of my matured age. One advantage, among the many, of addressing my memoirs, if I may give these sheets a name so imposing, to a dear and intimate friend, is, that I may spare some of the details, in this case unnecessary, with which I must needs have detained a stranger from what I have to say of greater interest. Why should I bestow all my tediousness upon you, because I have you in my power, and have ink, paper, and time before me? At the same time, I dare not promise that I may not abuse the opportunity so temptingly offered me, to treat of myself and my own concerns, even though I speak of circumstances as well known to you as to myself. The seductive love of narrative, when we ourselves are the heroes of the events which we tell, often disregards the attention due to the time and patience of the audience, and the best and wisest have yielded to its fascination. I need only remind you of a singular instance evinced by the form of that rare and original edition of Sully's memoirs, which you, with the fond vanity of a book collector, insist upon preferring to that which is reduced to the useful and ordinary form of memoirs, but which I think curious, solely as illustrating how far so great a man as the author was accessible to the foible of self-importance. If I recollect rightly, that venerable peer and great statesman had appointed no fewer than 4 gentlemen of his household to draw up the events of his life, under the title of Memorials of the Sage in Royal Affairs of State, Domestic, Political, and Military, transacted by Henry IV, and so forth. These grave recorders, having made their compilation, reduced the memoirs containing all the remarkable events of their master's life into a narrative, addressed to himself in propria persona. And thus, instead of telling his own story, in the third person, like Julius Caesar, or in the first person, like most who, in the hall, or the study, undertake to be the heroes of their own tale, Sully enjoyed the refined, though whimsical pleasure, of having the events of his life told over to him by his secretaries, being himself the auditor, as he was also the hero, and probably the author, of the whole book. It must have been a great sight to have seen the ex-minister, as bolt upright as a starched ruff and laced cassock could make him, seated in state beneath his canopy, and listening to the recitation of his compilers, while, standing bare in his presence, they informed him gravely, "Thus said the Duke, so did the Duke infer, such were your Grace's sentiments upon this important point, such were your secret counsels to the King on that other emergency," circumstances, all of which must have been much better known to their hearer than to themselves, and most of which could only be derived from his own special communication. My situation is not quite so ludicrous as that of the great Sully, and yet there would be something whimsical in Frank Osbaldistone giving Will Tresham a formal account of his birth, education, and connections in the world. I will, therefore, wrestle with the tempting spirit of P. P., clerk of our parish, as I best may, and endeavor to tell you nothing that is familiar to you already. Some things, however, I must recall to your memory, because, though formerly well known to you, they may have been forgotten through lapse of time, and they afford the groundwork of my destiny. You must remember my father well, for, as your own was a member of the mercantile house, you knew him from infancy. Yet you hardly saw him in his best days, before age and infirmity had quenched his ardent spirit of enterprise and speculation. He would have been a poor man, indeed, but perhaps as happy, had he devoted to the extension of science those active energies, and acute powers of observation, for which commercial pursuits found occupation. Yet, in the fluctuations of mercantile speculation, there is something captivating to the adventurer, even independent of the hope of gain. He who embarks on that fickle sea, requires to possess the skill of the pilot and the fortitude of the navigator, and after all may be wrecked and lost, unless the gales of fortune breathe in his favor. This mixture of necessary attention and inevitable hazard, the frequent and awful uncertainty whether prudence shall overcome fortune, or fortune baffle the schemes of prudence, affords full occupation for the powers, as well as for the feelings of the mind, and trade has all the fascination of gambling without its moral guild. Early in the 18th century, when I, heaven help me, was a youth of some 20 years old, I was summoned suddenly from Bordeaux to attend my father on business of importance. I shall never forget our first interview. You recollect the brief, abrupt, and somewhat stern mode in which he was wont to communicate his pleasure to those around him. Methinks I see him even now in my mind's eye, the firm and upright figure, the step, quick and determined, the eye, which shot so keen and so penetrating a glance, the features, on which care had already planted wrinkles, and here his language, in which he never wasted word in vain, expressed in a voice which had sometimes an occasional harshness, far from the intention of the speaker. When I dismounted from my post-horse, I hastened to my father's apartment. He was traversing it with an air of composed and steady deliberation, which even my arrival, although an only son unseen for 4 years, was unable to discompose. I threw myself into his arms. He was a kind, though not a fond father, and the tear twinkled in his dark eye, but it was only for a moment. Dubourg writes to me that he is satisfied with you, Frank. I am happy, Sir Dash. But I have less reason to be so, he added, sitting down at his bureau. I am sorry, Sir Dash. Sorry and happy, Frank, are words that, on most occasions, signify little or nothing. Here is your last letter. He took it out from a number of others tied up in a parcel of red tape, and curiously labeled and filed. There lay my poor epistle, written on the subject the nearest to my heart at the time, and couched in words which I had thought would work compassion if not conviction. There, I say, it lay, squeezed up among the letters on miscellaneous business in which my father's daily affairs had engaged him. I cannot help smiling internally when I recollect the mixture of hurt vanity, and wounded feeling, with which I regarded my remonstrance, to the penning of which there had gone, I promise you, some trouble, as I beheld it extracted from amongst letters of advice, of credit, and all the commonplace lumber, as I then thought them, of a merchant's correspondence. Surely, thought I, a letter of such importance, I dared not say, even to myself, so well written, deserved a separate place, as well as more anxious consideration, than those on the ordinary business of the counting house. But my father did not observe my dissatisfaction, and would not have minded it if he had. He proceeded, with a letter in his hand. This, Frank, is yours of the 21st ultimo, in which you advise me, reading from my letter, that in the most important business of forming a plan, and adopting a profession for life, you trust my paternal goodness will hold you entitled to at least a negative voice, that you have insuperable is the word I wish, by the way, you would write a more distinct current hand, draw a score through the tops of your T's, and open the loops of your L's insuperable objections to the arrangements which I have proposed to you. There is much more to the same effect, occupying 4 good pages of paper, which a little attention to perspicuity and distinctness of expression might have comprised within as many lines. For, after all, Frank, it amounts but to this, that you will not do as I would have you. That I cannot, sir, in the present instance, not that I will not. Words avail very little with me, young man, said my father, whose inflexibility always possessed the air of the most perfect calmness of self-possession. Cannot may be a more civil phrase than will not, but the expressions are synonymous where there is no moral impossibility. But I am not a friend to doing business hastily, we will talk this matter over after dinner. Owen. Owen appeared, not with the silver locks which you were used to venerate, for he was then little more than 50, but he had the same, or an exactly similar uniform suit of light brown clothes, the same pearl-gray silk stockings, the same stock, with its silver buckle, the same plaited cambric ruffles, drawn down over his knuckles in the parlor, but in the counting house carefully folded back under the sleeves, that they might remain unstained by the ink which he daily consumed, in a word, the same grave, formal, yet benevolent cast of features, which continued to his death to distinguish the head clerk of the great house of Osbaldistone and Tritian. "Owen," said my father, as the kind old man shook me affectionately by the hand, "you must dine with us today, and hear the news Frank has brought us from our friends in Bordeaux." Owen made one of his stiff bows of respectful gratitude, for, in those days, when the distance between superiors and inferiors was enforced in a manner to which the present times are strangers, such an invitation was a favor of some little consequence. "I shall long remember that dinner party." Deeply affected by feelings of anxiety, not unmingled with displeasure, I was unable to take that active share in the conversation which my father seemed to expect from me, and I too frequently gave unsatisfactory answers to the questions with which he assailed me. Owen, hovering betwixt his respect for his patron, and his love for the youth he had dandled on his knee in childhood, like the timorous, yet anxious ally of an invaded nation, endeavored at every blunder I made to explain my no meaning, and to cover my retreat, maneuvers which added to my father's pettish displeasure, and brought a share of it upon my kind advocate, instead of protecting me. I had not, while residing in the house of Dubourg, absolutely conducted myself like a clerk condemned his father's soul to cross, who penned a stanza when he should engross, dash. But, to say truth, I had frequented the counting house no more than I had thought absolutely necessary to secure the good report of the Frenchman, long a correspondent of our firm, to whom my father had trusted for initiating me into the mysteries of commerce. In fact, my principal attention had been dedicated to literature and manly exercises. My father did not altogether discourage such acquirements, whether mental or personal. He had too much good sense not to perceive that they sate gracefully upon every man, and he was sensible that they relieved and dignified the character to which he wished me to aspire. But his chief ambition was that I should succeed not merely to his fortune, but to the views and plans by which he imagined he could extend and perpetuate the wealthy inheritance which he designed for me. Love of his profession was the motive which he chose should be most ostensible, when he urged me to tread the same path, but he had others with which I only became acquainted at a later period. Impetuous in his schemes, as well as skillful and daring, each new adventure, when successful, became at once the incentive, and furnished the means, for farther speculation. It seemed to be necessary to him, as to an ambitious conqueror, to push on from achievement to achievement, without stopping to secure, far less to enjoy, the acquisitions which he made. Accustomed to see his whole fortune trembling in the scales of chance, and dexterous at adopting expedients for casting the balance in his favor, his health and spirits and activity seemed ever to increase with the animating hazards on which he staked his wealth, and he resembled a sailor, accustomed to brave the billows and the foe, whose confidence rises on the eve of tempest or of battle. He was not, however, insensible to the changes which increasing age or supervening malady might make in his own constitution, and was anxious in good time to secure in me an assistant, who might take the helm when his hand grew weary, and keep the vessel's way according to his counsel and instruction. Paternal affection, as well as the furtherance of his own plans, determined him to the same conclusion. Your father, though his fortune was vested in the house, was only a sleeping partner, as the commercial phrase goes, and Owen, whose probity and skill in the details of arithmetic rendered his services invaluable as a head clerk, was not possessed either of information or talents sufficient to conduct the mysteries of the principal management. If my father were suddenly summoned from life, what would become of the world of schemes which he had formed, unless his son were molded into a commercial Hercules, fit to sustain the weight when relinquished by the falling Atlas? And what would become of that son himself, if, a stranger to business of this description, he found himself at once involved in a labyrinth of mercantile concerns, without the clue of knowledge necessary for his extraction? For all these reasons, avowed in secret, my father was determined I should embrace his profession, and when he was determined, the resolution of no man was more immovable. I, however, was also a party to be consulted, and, with something of his own pertinacity, I had formed a determination precisely contrary. It may, I hope, be some palliative for the resistance which, on this occasion, I offered to my father's wishes, that I did not fully understand upon what they were founded, or how deeply his happiness was involved in them. Imagining myself certain of a large succession in future, and ample maintenance in the meanwhile, it never occurred to me that it might be necessary, in order to secure these blessings, to submit to labor and limitations unpleasant to my taste and temper. I only saw in my father's proposal for my engaging in business, a desire that I should add to those heaps of wealth which he had himself acquired, and imagining myself the best judge of the path to my own happiness, I did not conceive that I should increase that happiness by augmenting a fortune which I believed was already sufficient, and more than sufficient, for every use, comfort, and elegant enjoyment. Accordingly, I am compelled to repeat, that my time at Bordeaux had not been spent as my father had proposed to himself. What he considered as the chief end of my residence in that city, I had postponed for every other, and would, had I dared, have neglected altogether. Dubourg, a favored and benefited correspondent of our mercantile house, was too much of a shrewd politician to make such reports to the head of the firm concerning his only child, as would excite the displeasure of both, and he might also, as you will presently hear, have views of selfish advantage in suffering me to neglect the purposes for which I was placed under his charge. My conduct was regulated by the bounds of decency and good order, and thus far he had no evil report to make, supposing him so disposed, but, perhaps, the crafty Frenchman would have been equally complacent, had I been in the habit of indulging worse feelings than those of indolence and aversion to mercantile business. As it was, while I gave a decent portion of my time to the commercial studies he recommended, he was by no means envious of the hours which I dedicated to other and more classical attainments, nor did he ever find fault with me for dwelling upon Corneille and Boileau, in preference to Postlethwaite, supposing his folio to have then existed, and Monsieur Dubourg able to have pronounced his name, or Savary, or any other writer on commercial economy. He had picked up somewhere a convenient expression, with which he rounded off every letter to his correspondent. I was all, he said, that a father could wish. My father never quarreled with a phrase, however frequently repeated, provided it seemed to him distinct and expressive, and Addison himself could not have found expression so satisfactory to him as, yours received, and duly honored the bills enclosed, as per margin. Knowing, therefore, very well what he desired me to be, Mr. Osbaldistone made no doubt, from the frequent repetition of Dubourg's favorite phrase, that I was the very thing he wished to see me, when, in an evil hour, he received my letter, containing my eloquent and detailed apology for declining a place in the firm, and a desk and stool in the corner of the dark counting house in Crane Alley, surmounting in height those of Owen, and the other clerks, and only inferior to the tripod of my father himself. All was wrong from that moment. Dubourg's reports became as suspicious as if his bills had been noted for dishonor. I was summoned home in all haste, and received in the manner I have already communicated to you. Chapter 2. I begin shrewdly to suspect the young man of a terrible taint poetry, with which idle disease if he be infected, there's no hope of him in a state course. Act a mest of him for a commonwealth's man, if he go tot in rhyme once. Ben Jonson's Bartholomew Fair. My father had, generally speaking, his temper under complete self-command, and his anger rarely indicated itself by words, except in a sort of dry testy manner, to those who had displeased him. He never used threats, or expressions of loud resentment. All was arranged with him on system, and it was his practice to do the needful on every occasion, without wasting words about it. It was, therefore, with a bitter smile that he listened to my imperfect answers concerning the state of commerce in France, and unmercifully permitted me to involve myself deeper and deeper in the mysteries of agio, tariffs, terre and traite, nor can I charge my memory with his having looked positively angry, until he found me unable to explain the exact effect which the depreciation of the louis d'or had produced on the negotiation of bills of exchange. The most remarkable national occurrence in my time, said my father, who nevertheless had seen the revolution, and he knows no more of it than a post on the quay. Mr. Francis, suggested Owen, in his timid and conciliatory manner, cannot have forgotten, that by an arrêt of the King of France, dated 1st of May 1700, it was provided that the porteur, within 10 days after due, must make demand dash. Mr. Francis, said my father, interrupting him, will, I dare say, recollect for the moment anything you are so kind as hint to him. But, body o' me, how Dubourg could permit him? Hark ye, Owen, what sort of a youth is Clement Dubourg, his nephew there, in the office, the black-haired lad? One of the cleverest clerks, sir, in the house, a prodigious young man for his time, answered Owen, for the gaiety and civility of the young Frenchman had won his heart. I suppose he knows something of the nature of exchange. Dubourg was determined I should have one youngster at least about my hand who understood business. But I see his drift, and he shall find that I do so when he looks at the balance sheet. Owen, let Clement's salary be paid up to next quarter day, and let him ship himself back to Bordeaux in his father's ship, which is clearing out yonder. Dismiss Clement Dubourg, sir? Said Owen, with a faltering voice. "Yes, sir, dismiss him instantly. It is enough to have a stupid Englishman in the counting house to make blunders, without keeping a sharp Frenchman there to profit by them." I had lived long enough in the territories of the Grand Monarque to contract a hearty aversion to arbitrary exertion of authority, even if it had not been instilled into me with my earliest breeding, and I could not refrain from interposing, to prevent an innocent and meritorious young man from paying the penalty of having acquired that proficiency which my father had desired for me. "I beg pardon, sir," when Mr. Osbaldistone had done speaking, "but I think it but just, that if I have been negligent of my studies, I should pay the forfeit myself. I have no reason to charge Monsieur Dubourg with having neglected to give me opportunities of improvement, however little I may have profited by them, and with respect to Monsieur Clement Dubourg - with respect to him, and to you, I shall take the measures which I see needful," replied my father, "but it is fair in you, Frank, to take your own blame on your own shoulders, very fair, that cannot be denied. I cannot acquit old Dubourg," he said, looking to Owen, "for having merely afforded Frank the means of useful knowledge, without either seeing that he took advantage of them or reporting to me if he did not. You see, Owen, he has natural notions of equity becoming a British merchant." "Mr. Francis," said the head clerk, with his usual formal inclination of the head, and a slight elevation of his right hand, which he had acquired by a habit of sticking his pen behind his ear before he spoke, "Mr. Francis seems to understand the fundamental principle of all moral accounting, the great ethic rule of three. Let a due to be, as he would have be due to him, the product will give the rule of conduct required." My father smiled at this reduction of the golden rule to arithmetical form, but instantly proceeded. "All this signifies nothing, Frank. You have been throwing away your time like a boy, and in future you must learn to live like a man. I shall put you under Owen's care for a few months, to recover the lost ground." I was about to reply, but Owen looked at me with such a supplicatory and warning gesture, that I was involuntarily silent. "We will then," continued my father, "resume the subject of mine of the first ultimo, to which you sent me an answer which was unadvised and unsatisfactory. So now, fill your glass, and push the bottle to Owen." One of courage, of audacity if you will, was never my failing. I answered firmly, "I was sorry that my letter was unsatisfactory, unadvised it was not, for I had given the proposal his goodness had made me, my instant and anxious attention, and it was with no small pain that I found myself obliged to decline it." My father bent his keen eye for a moment on me, and instantly withdrew it. As he made no answer, I thought myself obliged to proceed, though with some hesitation, and he only interrupted me by monosyllables, "It is impossible, sir, for me to have higher respect for any character than I have for the commercial, even were it not yours. Indeed. It connects nation with nation, relieves the wants, and contributes to the wealth of all, and is to the general commonwealth of the civilized world what the daily intercourse of ordinary life is to private society, or rather, what air and food are to our bodies. Well, sir? And yet, sir, I find myself compelled to persist in declining to adopt a character which I am so ill qualified to support. I will take care that you acquire the qualifications necessary. You are no longer the guest and pupil of Dubourg. But, my dear sir, it is no defect of teaching which I plead, but my own inability to profit by instruction." "Nonsense. Have you kept your journal in the terms I desired?"
"Yes, sir."
"Be pleased to bring it here." The volume thus required was a sort of commonplace book, kept by my father's recommendation, in which I had been directed to enter notes of the miscellaneous information which I had acquired in the course of my studies. Foreseeing that he would demand inspection of this record, I had been attentive to transcribe such particulars of information as he would most likely be pleased with, but too often the pen had discharged the task without much correspondence with the head. And it had also happened, that, the book being the receptacle nearest to my hand, I had occasionally jotted down memoranda which had little regard to traffic. I now put it into my father's hand, devoutly hoping he might light on nothing that would increase his displeasure against me. Owen's face, which had looked something blank when the question was put, cleared up at my ready answer, and wore a smile of hope, when I brought from my apartment, and placed before my father, a commercial-looking volume, rather broader than it was long, having brazen clasps and a binding of rough calf. This looked businesslike, and was encouraging to my benevolent well-wisher. But he actually smiled with pleasure as he heard my father run over some part of the contents, muttering his critical remarks as he went on. "Brandy's barrels and barricades, also tonneau. At Nantes 29 vels to the barrique at Cognac and Rochelle 27 at Bordeaux 32 very right, Frank duties on tonnage and custom house, see Saxby's tables that's not well, You should have transcribed the passage. It fixes the thing in the memory reports outward and inward corn debentures over seacockets linens isingham gentis stockfish titling cropling lub fish. You should have noted that they are all, nevertheless to be entered as titlings. How many inches long is a titling? Owen, seeing me at fault, hazarded a whisper, of which I fortunately caught the import. 18 inches, sir. Dash. And a lubfish is 24 very right. It is important to remember this, on account of the Portuguese trade, but what have we here? Dash Bordeaux founded in the year Castle of the Trompet Palace of Galeanus. Well, that's very right too. This is a kind of waste book, Owen, in which all the transactions of the day, emptions, orders, payments, receipts, acceptances, drafts, commissions, and advices, are entered miscellaneously. That they may be regularly transferred to the daybook and ledger, answered Owen, I am glad Mr. Francis is so methodical. I perceived myself getting so fast into favor, that I began to fear the consequence would be my father's more obstinate perseverance in his resolution that I must become a merchant, and as I was determined on the contrary, I began to wish I had not, to use my friend Mr. Owen's phrase, been so methodical. But I had no reason for apprehension on that score, for a blotted piece of paper dropped out of the book, and, being taken up by my father, he interrupted a hint from Owen, on the propriety of securing loose memoranda with a little paste, by exclaiming, to the memory of Edward the Black Prince, what's all this? Verses. By heaven, Frank, you are a greater blockhead than I supposed you. My father, you must recollect, as a man of business, looked upon the labor of poets with contempt, and as a religious man, and of the dissenting persuasion, he considered all such pursuits as equally trivial and profane. Before you condemn him, you must recall to remembrance how too many of the poets in the end of the 17th century had led their lives and employed their talents. The sect also to which my father belonged, felt, or perhaps affected, a puritanical aversion to the lighter exertions of literature. So that many causes contributed to augment the unpleasant surprise occasioned by the ill-timed discovery of this unfortunate copy of verses. As for poor Owen, could the bob wig which he then wore have uncurled itself, and stood on end with horror, I am convinced the morning's labor of the friseur would have been undone, merely by the excess of his astonishment at this enormity. An inroad on the strong box, or an erasure in the ledger, or a mis summation in a fitted account, could hardly have surprised him more disagreeably. My father read the lines sometimes with an affectation of not being able to understand the sense, sometimes in a mouthing tone of mock heroic, always with an emphasis of the most bitter irony, most irritating to the nerves of an author. Oh, for the voice of that wild horn, on Font Arabian echoes borne, the dying hero's call, that told imperial Charlemagne, how Paynim sons of swarthy Spain had wrought his champions' fall. Font Arabian echoes. Continued my father, interrupting himself, the Font Arabian fair would have been more to the purpose Paynim. What's Paynim? Could you not say pagan as well, and write English at least, if you must needs write nonsense? Dash. Sat over earth and ocean sounding. And England's distant cliffs astounding. Such are the notes should say how Britain's hope, and France's fear, victor of Crecy and Poitiers, in Bordeaux dying lay. Poitiers, by the way, is always spelt with an S, and I know no reason why orthography should give place to rhyme. Dash. Raise my feigned head, my squires, he said, and let the casement be displayed, that I may see once more the splendor of the setting sun gleam on thy mirrored wave, Garonne, and Bly's empurpled shore. Garonne and sun is a bad rhyme. Why, Frank, you do not even understand the beggarly trade you have chosen. Like me, he sinks to glory's sleep, his fall the dews of evening steep, as if in sorrow shed, so soft shall fall the trickling tear, when England's maids and matrons hear of their Black Edward dead. And though my son of glory set, nor France, nor England, shall forget the terror of my name, and oft shall Britain's heroes rise, new planets in these southern skies, through clouds of blood and flame. A cloud of flame is something new, good morrow, my masters all, and a merry Christmas to you. Why, the bellman writes better lines. He then tossed the paper from him with an air of superlative contempt, and concluded upon my credit, Frank, you are a greater blockhead than I took you for. What could I say, my dear Tritian? There I stood, swelling with indignant mortification, while my father regarded me with a calm but stern look of scorn and pity, and poor Owen, with uplifted hands and eyes, looked as striking a picture of horror as if he had just read his patron's name in the Gazette. At length I took courage to speak, endeavoring that my tone of voice should betray my feelings as little as possible. I am quite aware, sir, how ill qualified I am to play the conspicuous part in society you have destined for me, and, luckily,
I am not ambitious of the wealth I might acquire. Mr. Owen would be a much more effective assistant. I said this in some malice, for I considered Owen as having deserted my cause a little too soon. Owen, said my father, the boy is mad, actually insane. And, pray, sir, if I may presume to inquire, having coolly turned me over to Mr. Owen, although I may expect more attention from anyone than from my son, what may your own sage projects be? I should wish, sir, I replied, summoning up my courage, to travel for 2 or 3 years, should that consist with your pleasure. Otherwise, although late, I would willingly spend the same time at Oxford or Cambridge. In the name of common sense, was the like ever heard? To put yourself to school among pedants and Jacobites, when you might be pushing your fortune in the world. Why not go to Westminster or Eton at once, man, and take to Lilly's Grammar and Accidence, and to the Birch, too, if you like it? Then, sir, if you think my plan of improvement too late, I would willingly return to the Continent. You have already spent too much time there to little purpose, Mr. Francis. Then I would choose the army, sir, in preference to any other active line of life. Choose the DL, answered my father, hastily, and then checking himself, I profess you make me as great a fool as you are yourself. Is he not enough to drive one mad, Owen? Poor Owen shook his head, and looked down. Hark ye, Frank, continued my father, I will cut all this matter very short. I was at your age when my father turned me out of doors, and settled my legal inheritance on my younger brother. I left Osbaldistone Hall on the back of a broken-down hunter, with 10 guineas in my purse. I have never crossed the threshold again, and I never will. I know not, and I care not, if my fox-hunting brother is alive, or has broken his neck, but he has children, Frank, and one of them shall be my son if you cross me farther in this matter. You will be your pleasure, I answered rather, I fear, with more sullen indifference than respect, with what is your own. Yes, Frank, what I have is my own, if labor in getting, and care in augmenting, can make a right of property, and no drone shall feed on my honeycomb. Think on it well, what I have said is not without reflection, and what I resolve upon I will execute. Honored sir! Dear sir! Exclaimed Owen, tears rushing into his eyes, you are not wont to be in such a hurry in transacting business of importance. Let Mr. Francis run up the balance before you shut the account, he loves you, I am sure, and when he puts down his filial obedience to the per contra, I am sure his objections will disappear. Do you think I will ask him twice, said my father, sternly, to be my friend, my assistant, and my confidant? To be a partner of my cares and of my fortune? Owen, I thought you had known me better. He looked at me as if he meant to add something more, but turned instantly away, and left the room abruptly. I was, I own, affected by this view of the case, which had not occurred to me, and my father would probably have had little reason to complain of me, had he commenced the discussion with this argument. But it was too late. I had much of his own obduracy of resolution, and heaven had decreed that my sin should be my punishment, though not to the extent which my transgression merited. Owen, when we were left alone, continued to look at me with eyes which tears from time to time moistened, as if to discover, before attempting the task of intercessor, upon what point my obstinacy was most assailable. At length he began, with broken and disconcerted accents, "Old, Mr. Francis. Good heavens, sir. My stars, Mr. Osbaldistone. That I should ever have seen this day and you so young a gentleman, sir. For the love of heaven. Look at both sides of the account, think what you are going to lose, a noble fortune, sir, one of the finest houses in the city, even under the old firm of Tresham and Trent, and now Osbaldistone and Tresham you might roll in gold, Mr. Francis and, my dear young Mr. Frank, if there was any particular thing in the business of the house which you disliked, I would, sinking his voice to a whisper, put it in order for you termly, or weekly, or daily, if you will do, my dear Mr. Francis, think of the honor due to your father, that your days may be long in the land. I am much obliged to you, Mr. Owen, said I, very much obliged indeed, but my father is best judge how to bestow his money. He talks of one of my cousins, let him dispose of his wealth as he pleases, I will never sell my liberty for gold. Gold, sir? I wish you saw the balance sheet of profits at last term, it was in five figures to each partner's sum total, Mr. Frank, and all this is to go to a papist, and a North Country booby, and a disaffected person besides, it will break my heart, Mr. Francis, that have been toiling more like a dog than a man, and all for love of the firm. Think how it will sound, Osbaldistone, Tresham, and Osbaldistone, or perhaps, who knows, again lowering his voice, Osbaldistone, and Tresham, for our Mr. Osbaldistone can buy them all out. But, Mr. Owen, my cousin's name being also Osbaldistone, the name of the company will sound every bit as well in your ears. Oh fie upon you, Mr. Francis, when you know how well I love you, your cousin, indeed. A papist, no doubt, like his father, and a disaffected person to the Protestant succession, that's another item, doubtless. There are many very good men Catholics, Mr. Owen, rejoined I. As Owen was about to answer with unusual animation, my father re-entered the apartment. You were right, he said, Owen, and I was wrong. We will take more time to think over this matter. Young man, you will prepare to give me an answer on this important subject this day month. I bowed in silence, sufficiently glad of a reprieve, and trusting it might indicate some relaxation in my father's determination. The time of probation passed slowly, unmarked by any accident whatever. I went and came, and disposed of my time as I pleased, without question or criticism on the part of my father. Indeed, I rarely saw him, save at mealtimes, when he studiously avoided a discussion which you may well suppose I was in no hurry to press onward. Our conversation was of the news of the day, or on such general topics as strangers discourse upon to each other, nor could any one have guessed, from its tenor, that there remained undecided betwixt us a dispute of such importance. It haunted me, however, more than once, like the nightmare. Was it possible he would keep his word, and disinherit his only son in favor of a nephew whose very existence he was not perhaps quite certain of? My grandfather's conduct, in similar circumstances, boded me no good, had I considered the matter rightly. But I had formed an erroneous idea of my father's character, from the importance which I recollected I maintained with him and his whole family before I went to France. I was not aware that there are men who indulge their children at an early age, because to do so interests and amuses them, and who can yet be sufficiently severe when the same children cross their expectations at a more advanced period. On the contrary, I persuaded myself that all I had to apprehend was some temporary alienation of affection, perhaps a rustication of a few weeks, which I thought would rather please me than otherwise, since it would give me an opportunity of setting about my unfinished version of Orlando Furioso, a poem which I longed to render into English verse. I suffered this belief to get such absolute possession of my mind, that I had resumed my blotted papers, and was busy in meditation on the oft-recurring rhymes of the Spenserian stanza, when I heard a low and cautious tap at the door of my apartment. "Come in," I said, and Mr. Owen entered. So regular were the motions and habits of this worthy man, that in all probability this was the first time he had ever been in the second story of his patron's house, however conversant with the first, and I am still at a loss to know in what manner he discovered my apartment. "Mr. Francis," he said, interrupting my expression of surprise and pleasure at seeing him, "I do not know if I am doing well in what I am about to say. It is not right to speak of what passes in the compting house out of doors. One should not tell, as they say, to the post in the warehouse, how many lines there are in the ledger. But young Twineal has been absent from the house for a fortnight and more, until 2 days since." "Very well, my dear sir, and how does that concern us?" "Stay, Mr. Francis, your father gave him a private commission, and I am sure he did not go down to Falmouth about the Pilchard affair, and the Exeter business with Blackwell and Company has been settled, and the mining people in Cornwall, Trevanion, and Tregwilliam, have paid all they are likely to pay, and any other matter of business must have been put through my books. In short, it's my faithful belief that Twineal has been down in the north." "Do you really suppose?" So said I, somewhat startled. "He has spoken about nothing, sir, since he returned, but his new boots, and his rip and spurs, and a cockfight at York. It's as true as the multiplication table. Do, heaven bless you, my dear child, make up your mind to please your father, and to be a man and a merchant at once." I felt at that instant a strong inclination to submit, and to make Owen happy by requesting him to tell my father that I resigned myself to his disposal. But pride, pride, the source of so much that is good and so much that is evil in our course of life, prevented me. My acquiescence stuck in my throat, and while I was coughing to get it up, my father's voice summoned Owen. He hastily left the room, and the opportunity was lost. My father was methodical in everything. At the very same time of the day, in the same apartment, and with the same tone and manner which he had employed an exact month before, he recapitulated the proposal he had made for taking me into partnership, and assigning me a department in the counting house, and requested to have my final decision. I thought at the time there was something unkind in this, and I still think that my father's conduct was injudicious. A more conciliatory treatment would, in all probability, have gained his purpose. As it was, I stood fast, and, as respectfully as I could, declined the proposal he made to me. Perhaps, for who can judge of their own heart? I felt it unmanly to yield on the first summons, and expected farther solicitation, as at least a pretext for changing my mind. If so, I was disappointed, for my father turned coolly to Owen, and only said, "You see, it is as I told you. Well, Frank," addressing me, "you are nearly of age, and as well qualified to judge of what will constitute your own happiness as you ever are like to be, therefore, I say no more. But as I am not bound to give in to your plans, any more than you are compelled to submit to mine, may I ask to know if you have formed any which depend on my assistance?" I answered, not a little abashed, that being bred to no profession, and having no funds of my own, it was obviously impossible for me to subsist without some allowance from my father, that my wishes were very moderate, and that I hoped my aversion for the profession to which he had designed me, would not occasion his altogether withdrawing his paternal support and protection. "That is to say, you wish to lean on my arm, and yet to walk your own way? That can hardly be, Frank. However, I suppose you mean to obey my directions, so far as they do not cross your own humor?" I was about to speak silence, "if you please," he continued. "Supposing this to be the case, you will instantly set out for the north of England, to pay your uncle a visit, and see the state of his family. I have chosen from among his sons, he has six, I believe, one who, I understand, is most worthy to fill the place I intended for you in the counting house. But some farther arrangements may be necessary, and for these your presence may be requisite. You shall have farther instructions at Osbaldistone Hall, where you will please to remain until you hear from me. Everything will be ready for your departure tomorrow morning." With these words my father left the apartment. "What does all this mean, Mr. Owen?" said I to my sympathetic friend, whose countenance wore a cast of the deepest dejection. "You have ruined yourself, Mr. Frank, that's all. When your father talks in that quiet, determined manner, there will be no more change in him than in a fitted account." And so it proved, for the next morning, at 5 o'clock, I found myself on the road to York, mounted on a reasonably good horse, and with 50 guineas in my pocket, travelling, as it would seem, for the purpose of assisting in the adoption of a successor to myself in my father's house and favour, and, for aught I knew, eventually in his fortune also. Chapter 3. The slack sail shifts from side to side, the boat, untrimmed, admits the tide, borne down, adrift, at random toast, the oar breaks short, the rudder's lost. Gay's Fables. I have tagged with rhyme and blank verse the subdivisions of this important narrative, in order to seduce your continued attention by powers of composition of stronger attraction than my own. The preceding lines refer to an unfortunate navigator, who daringly unloosed from its moorings a boat, which he was unable to manage, and thrust it off into the full tide of a navigable river. No schoolboy, who, betwixt frolic and defiance, has executed a similar rash attempt, could feel himself, when adrift in a strong current, in a situation more awkward than mine, when I found myself driving, without a compass, on the ocean of human life. There had been such unexpected ease in the manner in which my father slipped a knot, usually esteemed the strongest which binds society together, and suffered me to depart as a sort of outcast from his family, that it strangely lessened the confidence in my own personal accomplishments, which had hitherto sustained me. Prince Prettyman, now a prince, and now a fisher's son, had not a more awkward sense of his degradation. We are so apt, in our engrossing egotism, to consider all those accessories which are drawn around us by prosperity, as pertaining and belonging to our own persons, that the discovery of our unimportance, when left to our own proper resources, becomes inexpressibly mortifying. As the hum of London died away on my ear, the distant peal of her steeples more than once sounded to my ears the admonitory turn again, erst heard by her future Lord Mayor, and when I looked back from Highgate on her dusky magnificence, I felt as if I were leaving behind me comfort, opulence, the charms of society, and all the pleasures of cultivated life. But the die was cast. It was, indeed, by no means probable that a late and ungracious compliance with my father's wishes would have reinstated me in the situation which I had lost. On the contrary, firm and strong of purpose as he himself was, he might rather have been disgusted than conciliated by my tardy and compulsory acquiescence in his desire that I should engage in commerce. My constitutional obstinacy came also to my aid, and pride whispered how poor a figure I should make, when an airing of 4 miles from London had blown away resolutions formed during a month's serious deliberation. Hope, too, that never forsakes the young and hearty, lent her luster to my future prospects. My father could not be serious in the sentence of forced humiliation, which he had so unhesitatingly pronounced. It must be but a trial of my disposition, which, endured with patience and steadiness on my part, would raise me in his estimation, and lead to an amicable accommodation of the point in dispute between us. I even settled in my own mind how far I would concede to him, and on what articles of our supposed treaty I would make a firm stand, and the result was, according to my computation, that I was to be reinstated in my full rights of filiation, paying the easy penalty of some ostensible compliances to atone for my past rebellion. In the meanwhile, I was lord of my person, and experienced that feeling of independence which the youthful bosom receives with a thrilling mixture of pleasure and apprehension. My purse, though by no means amply replenished, was in a situation to supply all the wants and wishes of a traveler. I had been accustomed, while at Bordeaux, to act as my own valet. My horse was fresh, young, and active, and the buoyancy of my spirits soon surmounted the melancholy reflections with which my journey commenced. I should have been glad to have journeyed upon a line of road better calculated to afford reasonable objects of curiosity, or a more interesting country, to the traveler. But the North Road was then, and perhaps still is, singularly deficient in these respects, nor do I believe you can travel so far through Britain in any other direction without meeting more of what is worthy to engage the attention. My mental ruminations, notwithstanding my assumed confidence, were not always of an uncheckered nature. The muse too, the very coquette who had led me into this wilderness, like others of her sex, deserted me in my utmost need, and I should have been reduced to rather an uncomfortable state of dullness, had it not been for the occasional conversation of strangers who chanced to pass the same way. But the characters whom I met with were of a uniform and uninteresting description. Country parsons, jogging homewards after a visitation, farmers, or graziers, returning from a distant market, clerks of traders, traveling to collect what was due to their masters, in provincial towns, with now and then an officer going down into the country upon the recruiting service, were, at this period, the persons by whom the turnpikes and tapsters were kept in exercise. Our speech, therefore, was of tithes and creeds, of beeves and grain, of commodities wet and dry, and the solvency of the retail dealers, occasionally varied by the description of a siege, or battle, in Flanders, which, perhaps, the narrator only gave me at second hand. Robbers, a fertile and alarming theme, filled up every vacancy, and the names of the Golden Farmer, the Flying Highwayman, Jack Needham, and other beggars' opera heroes, were familiar in our mouths as household words. At such tales, like children closing their circle round the fire when the ghost story draws to its climax, the riders drew near to each other, looked before and behind them, examined the priming of their pistols, and vowed to stand by each other in case of danger, an engagement which, like other offensive and defensive alliances, sometimes glided out of remembrance when there was an appearance of actual peril. Of all the fellows whom I ever saw haunted by terrors of this nature, one poor man, with whom I travelled a day and a half, afforded me most amusement. He had upon his pillion a very small, but apparently a very weighty portmanteau, about the safety of which he seemed particularly solicitous, never trusting it out of his own immediate care, and uniformly repressing the officious zeal of the waiters and ostlers, who offered their services to carry it into the house. With the same precaution he labored to conceal, not only the purpose of his journey, and his ultimate place of destination, but even the direction of each day's route. Nothing embarrassed him more than to be asked by any one, whether he was traveling upwards or downwards, or at what stage he intended to bait. His place of rest for the night he scrutinized with the most anxious care, alike avoiding solitude, and what he considered as bad neighborhood, and at Grantham, I believe, he sate up all night to avoid sleeping in the next room to a thick-set squinting fellow, in a black wig, and a tarnished gold-laced waistcoat. With all these cares on his mind, my fellow traveler, to judge by his thews and sinews, was a man who might have set danger at defiance with as much impunity as most men. He was strong and well built, and, judging from his gold-laced hat and cockade, seemed to have served in the army, or, at least, to belong to the military profession in one capacity or other. His conversation also, though always sufficiently vulgar, was that of a man of sense, when the terrible bugbears which haunted his imagination for a moment ceased to occupy his attention. But every accidental association recalled them. An open heath, a close plantation, were alike subjects of apprehension, and the whistle of a shepherd lad was instantly converted into the signal of a depredator. Even the sight of a gibbet, if it assured him that one robber was safely disposed of by justice, never failed to remind him how many remained still unhanged. I should have wearied of this fellow's company, had I not been still more tired of my own thoughts. Some of the marvelous stories, however, which he related, had in themselves a cast of interest, and another whimsical point of his peculiarities afforded me the occasional opportunity of amusing myself at his expense. Among his tales, several of the unfortunate travelers who fell among thieves, incurred that calamity from associating themselves on the road with a well-dressed and entertaining stranger, in whose company they trusted to find protection as well as amusement, who cheered their journey with tale and song, protected them against the evils of overcharges and false reckonings, until at length, under pretext of showing a near path over a desolate common, he seduced his unsuspicious victims from the public road into some dismal glen, where, suddenly blowing his whistle, he assembled his comrades from their lurking place, and displayed himself in his true colors, the captain, namely, of the band of robbers to whom his unwary fellow travelers had forfeited their purses, and perhaps their lives. Towards the conclusion of such a tale, and when my companion had wrought himself into a fever of apprehension by the progress of his own narrative, I observed that he usually eyed me with a glance of doubt and suspicion, as if the possibility occurred to him, that he might, at that very moment, be in company with a character as dangerous as that which his tale described. And ever and anon, when such suggestions pressed themselves on the mind of this ingenious self-tormentor, he drew off from me to the opposite side of the high road, looked before, behind, and around him, examined his arms, and seemed to prepare himself for flight or defense, as circumstances might require. The suspicion implied on such occasions seemed to me only momentary, and too ludicrous to be offensive. There was, in fact, no particular reflection on my dress or address, although I was thus mistaken for a robber. A man in those days might have all the external appearance of a gentleman, and yet turn out to be a highwayman. For the division of labor in every department not having then taken place so fully as since that period, the profession of the polite and accomplished adventurer, who nicked you out of your money at White's, or bowled you out of it at Marylebone, was often united with that of the professed ruffian, who on Bagshot Heath, or Finchley Common, commanded his brother beau to stand and deliver. There was also a touch of coarseness and hardness about the manners of the times, which has since, in a great degree, been softened and shaded away. It seems to me, on recollection, as if desperate men had less reluctance then than now to embrace the most desperate means of retrieving their fortune. The times were indeed past, when Anthony of Wood mourned over the execution of two men, goodly in person, and of undisputed courage and honor, who were hanged without mercy at Oxford, merely because their distress had driven them to raise contributions on the highway. We were still farther removed from the days of the Mad Prince and Poins. And yet, from the number of unenclosed and extensive heaths in the vicinity of the metropolis, and from the less populous state of remote districts, both were frequented by that species of mounted highwaymen, that may possibly become one day unknown, who carried on their trade with something like courtesy, and, like Gibbet in the Beau Stratagem, piqued themselves on being the best behaved men on the road, and on conducting themselves with all appropriate civility in the exercise of their vocation. A young man, therefore, in my circumstances was not entitled to be highly indignant at the mistake which confounded him with this worshipful class of depredators. Neither was I offended. On the contrary, I found amusement in alternately exciting, and lulling to sleep, the suspicions of my timorous companion, and in purposely so acting as still farther to puzzle a brain which nature and apprehension had combined to render none of the clearest. When my free conversation had lulled him into complete security, it required only a passing inquiry concerning the direction of his journey, or the nature of the business which occasioned it, to put his suspicions once more in arms. For example, a conversation on the comparative strength and activity of our horses, took such a turn as follows, dash. "Oh, sir," said my companion, "for the gallop I grant you, but allow me to say, your horse, although he is a very handsome gelding that must be owned, has too little bone to be a good roadster. The trot, sir," striking his bucephalus with his spurs, "the trot is the true pace for a hackney, and, were we near a town, I should like to try the daisy cutter of yours upon a piece of level road, barring canter, for a quart of claret at the next inn." "Content, sir," replied I, "and here is a stretch of ground very favorable." "Hem, ahem," answered my friend with hesitation, "I make it a rule of traveling never to blow my horse between stages, one never knows what occasion he may have to put him to his mettle, and besides, sir, when I said I would match you, I meant with even weight. You ride 4 stone lighter than I." "Very well, but I am content to carry weight. Pray, what may that portmanteau of yours weigh?" "My PP portmanteau?" replied he, hesitating, "oh, very little, a feather, just a few shirts and stockings. I should think it heavier, from its appearance. I'll hold you the quart of claret it makes the odds betwixt our weight."
"You're mistaken, sir, I assure you, quite mistaken," replied my friend, edging off to the side of the road, as was his wont on these alarming occasions. "Well, I am willing to venture the wine, or, I will bet you 10 pieces to 5, that I carry your portmanteau on my croup, and out trot you into the bargain." This proposal raised my friend's alarm to the uttermost. His nose changed from the natural copper hue which it had acquired for many a comfortable cup of claret or sack, into a palish brassy tint, and his teeth chattered with apprehension at the unveiled audacity of my proposal, which seemed to place the barefaced plunderer before him in full atrocity. As he faltered for an answer, I relieved him in some degree by a question concerning a steeple, which now became visible, and an observation that we were now so near the village as to run no risk from interruption on the road. At this his countenance cleared up, but I easily perceived that it was long ere he forgot a proposal which seemed to him so fraught with suspicion as that which I had now hazarded. I trouble you with this detail of the man's disposition, and the manner in which I practiced upon it, because, however trivial in themselves, these particulars were attended by an important influence on future incidents which will occur in this narrative. At the time, this person's conduct only inspired me with contempt, and confirmed me in an opinion which I already entertained, that of all the propensities which teach mankind to torment themselves, that of causeless fear is the most irritating, busy, painful, and pitiable. Chapter 4. The Scots are poor, cries surly English pride. True is the charge, nor by themselves denied. Are they not, then, in strictest reason clear, who wisely come to mend their fortunes here? Churchill. There was, in the days of which I write, an old-fashioned custom on the English road, which I suspect is now obsolete, or practiced only by the vulgar. Journeys of length being made on horseback, and, of course, by brief stages, it was usual always to make a halt on the Sunday in some town where the traveller might attend divine service, and his horse have the benefit of the day of rest, the institution of which is as humane to our brute labourers as profitable to ourselves. A counterpart to this decent practice, and a remnant of old English hospitality, was, that the landlord of a principal inn laid aside his character of a publican on the seventh day, and invited the guests who chanced to be within his walls to take a part of his family beef and pudding. This invitation was usually complied with by all whose distinguished rank did not induce them to think compliance a derogation, and the proposal of a bottle of wine after dinner, to drink the landlord's health, was the only recompense ever offered or accepted. I was born a citizen of the world, and my inclination led me into all scenes where my knowledge of mankind could be enlarged. I had, besides, no pretensions to sequester myself on the score of superior dignity, and therefore seldom failed to accept of the Sunday's hospitality of mine host, whether of the garter, lion, or bear. The honest publican, dilated into additional consequence by a sense of his own importance, while presiding among the guests on whom it was his ordinary duty to attend, was in himself an entertaining spectacle, and around his genial orbit, other planets of inferior consequence performed their revolutions. The wits and humorists, the distinguished worthies of the town or village, the apothecary, the attorney, even the curate himself, did not disdain to partake of this hebdomadal festivity. The guests, assembled from different quarters, and following different professions, formed, in language, manners, and sentiments, a curious contrast to each other, not indifferent to those who desired to possess a knowledge of mankind in its varieties. It was on such a day, and such an occasion, that my timorous acquaintance and I were about to grace the board of the ruddy-faced host of the Black Bear, in the town of Darlington, and Bishopric of Durham, when our landlord informed us, with a sort of apologetic tone, that there was a Scotch gentleman to dine with us. A gentleman? What sort of a gentleman? Said my companion somewhat hastily, his mind, I suppose, running on gentlemen of the pad, as they were then termed. Why, a Scotch sort of a gentleman, as I said before, returned mine host, they are all gentle, ye moon know, though they han are a shirt to back, but this is a decentish hally in a canny North Britain as e'er crossed Berwick Bridge, I trow he's a dealer in cattle. Let us have his company, by all means, answered my companion, and then, turning to me, he gave vent to the tenor of his own reflections. I respect the Scotch, sir, I love and honor the nation for their sense of morality. Men talk of their filth and their poverty, but commend me to sterling honesty, though clad in rags, as the poet saith. I have been credibly assured, sir, by men on whom I can depend, that there was never known such a thing in Scotland as a highway robbery. That's because they have nothing to lose, said mine host, with a chuckle of a self-applauding wit. No, no, landlord, answered a strong deep voice behind him. It seems because your English gaugers and supervisors, that you have sent down beneath the Tweed, have tied up the trade of thievery over the heads of the native professors. The introduction of gaugers, supervisors, and examiners, was one of the great complaints of the Scottish nation, though a natural consequence of the Union. Well said, Mr. Kemble, answered the landlord, I did not think thou'dst been sae near us, Monday, but thou kens I'm an outspoken Yorkshire tyke. And how go markets in the South?
Even in the ordinary, replied Mr. Campbell, wise folks buy and sell, and fools are bought and sold.
But wise men and fools both eat their dinner, answered our jolly entertainer, and here a comes as prime a buttock of beef as e'er hungry men stuck fork in.
So saying, he eagerly whetted his knife, assumed his seat of empire at the head of the board, and loaded the plates of his sundry guests with his good cheer.
This was the first time I had heard the Scottish accent, or, indeed, that I had familiarly met with an individual of the ancient nation by whom it was spoken. Yet, from an early period, they had occupied and interested my imagination. My father, as is well known to you, was of an ancient family in Northumberland, from whose seat I was, while eating the aforesaid dinner, not very many miles distant. The quarrel betwixt him and his relatives was such, that he scarcely ever mentioned the race from which he sprung, and held as the most contemptible species of vanity, the weakness which is commonly termed family pride. His ambition was only to be distinguished as William Osbaldistone, the first, at least one of the first, merchants on change, and to have proved him the lineal representative of William the Conqueror would have far less flattered his vanity than the hum and bustle which his approach was wont to produce among the bulls, bears, and brokers of Stock Alley. He wished, no doubt, that I should remain in such ignorance of my relatives and descent as might ensure a correspondence between my feelings and his own on this subject. But his designs, as will happen occasionally to the wisest, were, in some degree at least, counteracted by a being whom his pride would never have supposed of importance adequate to influence them in any way. His nurse, an old Northumbrian woman, attached to him from his infancy, was the only person connected with his native province for whom he retained any regard, and when fortune dawned upon him, one of the first uses which he made of her favors, was to give Mabel Ricketts a place of residence within his household. After the death of my mother, the care of nursing me during my childish illnesses, and of rendering all those tender attentions which infancy exacts from female affection, devolved on old Mabel. Interdicted by her master from speaking to him on the subject of the heaths, glades, and dales of her beloved Northumberland, she poured herself forth to my infant ear in descriptions of the scenes of her youth, and long narratives of the events which tradition declared to have passed amongst them. To these I inclined my ear much more seriously than to graver, but less animated instructors. Even yet, methinks I see old Mabel, her head slightly agitated by the palsy of age, and shaded by a close cap, as white as the driven snow, her face wrinkled, but still retaining the healthy tinge which it had acquired in rural labor. I think I see her look around on the brick walls and narrow street which presented themselves before our windows, as she concluded with a sigh the favorite old ditty, which I then preferred, and why should I not tell the truth? Which I still prefer to all the opera airs ever minted by the capricious brain of an Italian muse. D-dash. Oh, the oak, the ash, and the bonny ivy tree, they flourish best at home in the North Country. Now, in the legends of Mabel, the Scottish nation was ever freshly remembered, with all the embittered declamation of which the narrator was capable. The inhabitants of the opposite frontier served in her narratives to fill up the parts which ogres and giants with seven-leagued boots occupy in the ordinary nursery tales. And how could it be otherwise? Was it not the Black Douglas who slew with his own hand the heir of the Osbaldistone family the day after he took possession of his estate, surprising him and his vassals while solemnizing a feast suited to the occasion? Was it not with the devil, who drove all the year-old hogs off the braes of Lanthorn side, in the very recent days of my grandfather's father? And had we not many a trophy, but, according to old Mabel's version of history, far more honorably gained, to mark our revenge of these wrongs? Did not Sir Henry Osbaldistone, fifth baron of the name, carry off the fair maid of Farrington, as Achilles did his Chryses and Briseis of old, and detain her in his fortress against all the power of her friends, supported by the most mighty Scottish chiefs of warlike fame? And had not our sword shone foremost at most of those fields in which England was victorious over a rival? All our family renown was acquired, all our family misfortunes were occasioned by the Northern Wars. Warmed by such tales, I looked upon the Scottish people during my childhood, as a race hostile by nature to the more southern inhabitants of this realm, and this view of the matter was not much corrected by the language which my father sometimes held with respect to them. He had engaged in some large speculations concerning oakwoods, the property of Highland proprietors, and alleged, that he found them much more ready to make bargains, and extort earnest of the purchase money, than punctual in complying on their side with the terms of the engagements. The Scottish mercantile men, whom he was under the necessity of employing as a sort of middleman on these occasions, were also suspected by my father of having secured, by one means or other, more than their own share of the profit which ought to have accrued. In short, if Mabel complained of the Scottish arms in ancient times,
Mr. Osbaldistone inveighed no less against the arts of these modern synods, and between them, though without any fixed purpose of doing so, they impressed my youthful mind with a sincere aversion to the northern inhabitants of Britain, as a people bloodthirsty in time of war, treacherous during truce, interested, selfish, avaricious, and tricky in the business of peaceful life, and having few good qualities, unless there should be accounted such, a ferocity which resembled courage in martial affairs, and a sort of wilycraft which supplied the place of wisdom in the ordinary commerce of mankind. In justification, or apology, for those who entertain such prejudices, I must remark, that the Scotch of that period were guilty of similar injustice to the English, whom they branded universally as a race of purse-proud arrogant epicures. Such seeds of national dislike remained between the two countries, the natural consequences of their existence as separate and rival states. We have seen recently the breath of a demagogue blow these sparks into a temporary flame, which I sincerely hope is now extinguished in its own ashes. This seems to have been written about the time of Wilkes and Liberty. It was, then, with an impression of dislike, that I contemplated the first Scotchman I chanced to meet in society. There was much about him that coincided with my previous conceptions. He had the hard features and athletic form said to be peculiar to his country, together with the national intonation and slow pedantic mode of expression, arising from a desire to avoid peculiarities of idiom or dialect. I could also observe the caution and shrewdness of his country in many of the observations which he made, and the answers which he returned. But I was not prepared for the air of easy self-possession and superiority with which he seemed to predominate over the company into which he was thrown, as it were by accident. His dress was as coarse as it could be, being still decent, and, at a time when great expense was lavished upon the wardrobe, even of the lowest who pretended to the character of gentlemen, this indicated mediocrity of circumstances, if not poverty. His conversation intimated that he was engaged in the cattle trade, no very dignified professional pursuit. And yet, under these disadvantages, he seemed, as a matter of course, to treat the rest of the company with the cool and condescending politeness which implies a real, or imagined, superiority over those towards whom it is used. When he gave his opinion on any point, it was with that easy tone of confidence used by those superior to their society in rank or information, as if what he said could not be doubted, and was not to be questioned. Mine host and his Sunday guests, after an effort or two to support their consequence by noise and bold averment, sunk gradually under the authority of Mr. Campbell, who thus fairly possessed himself of the lead in the conversation. I was tempted, from curiosity, to dispute the ground with him myself, confiding in my knowledge of the world, extended as it was by my residence abroad, and in the stores with which a tolerable education had possessed my mind. In the latter respect he offered no competition, and it was easy to see that his natural powers had never been cultivated by education. But I found him much better acquainted than I was myself with the present state of France, the character of the Duke of Orleans, who had just succeeded to the regency of that kingdom, and that of the statesmen by whom he was surrounded, and his shrewd, caustic, and somewhat satirical remarks, were those of a man who had been a close observer of the affairs of that country. On the subject of politics, Campbell observed a silence and moderation which might arise from caution. The divisions of Whig and Tory then shook England to her very center, and a powerful party, engaged in the Jacobite interest, menaced the dynasty of Hanover, which had been just established on the throne. Every alehouse resounded with the brawls of contending politicians, and as mine host's politics were of that liberal description which quarreled with no good customer, his hebdomadal visitants were often divided in their opinion as irreconcilably as if he had feasted the common council. The curate and the apothecary, with a little man, who made no boast of his vocation, but who, from the flourish and snap of his fingers, I believe to have been the barber, strongly espoused the cause of High Church and the Stuart line. The exciseman, as in duty bound, and the attorney, who looked to some petty office under the crown, together with my fellow traveller, who seemed to enter keenly into the contest, staunchly supported the cause of King George in the Protestant succession. Dire was the screaming, deep the oaths. Each party appealed to Mr. Campbell, anxious, it seemed, to elicit his approbation. "You are a Scotchman, sir, a gentleman of your country must stand up for hereditary right," cried one party. "You are a Presbyterian," assumed the other class of disputants, "you cannot be a friend to arbitrary power." "Gentlemen," said our Scotch oracle, after having gained, with some difficulty, a moment's pause, "I have in a much dubitation that King George Weal deserves the predilection of his friends, and if he can hold the grip he has gotten, why, doubtless, he may make the gager, here, a commissioner of the revenue, and confer on our friend, Mr. Keatham, the preferment of Solicitor General, and he may also grant some good deed or reward to this honest gentleman who is sitting upon his portmanteau, which he prefers to a chair, and, questionless, King James is also a grateful person, and when he gets his hand in play, he may, if he be so minded, make this reverend gentleman Archprelate of Canterbury, and drive Mixet chief physician to his household, and commit his royal beard to the care of my friend Latherham. But as I doubt mickle whether any of the competing sovereigns would give Rob Campbell a tass of equivity, if he lacked it, I give my vote and interest to Jonathan Brown, our landlord, to be the king and prince of skinkers, conditionally that he fetches us another bottle as good as the last. This sally was received with general applause, in which the landlord cordially joined, and when he had given orders for fulfilling the condition on which his preferment was to depend, he failed not to acquaint them, that, for as peaceable a gentleman as Mr. Campbell was, he was, moreover, as bold as a lion 7 highwaymen had he defeated with his single arm, that beset him as he came from Whitsuntrist. "Thou art deceived, friend Jonathan," said Campbell, interrupting him, "they were but barely 2, and 2 cowardly loons as man could wish to meet withal." "And did you, sir, really," said my fellow traveller, edging his chair, "I should have set his portmanteau, nearer to Mr. Campbell, really and actually beat 2 highwaymen yourself alone?"
"In troth did I, sir," replied Campbell, "and I think it nay great thing to make a saying about."
"Upon my word, sir," replied my acquaintance, "I should be happy to have the pleasure of your company on my journey I go northward, sir." This piece of gratuitous information concerning the route he proposed to himself, the first I had heard my companion bestow upon any one, failed to excite the corresponding confidence of the Scotchman. "We can scarce travel together," he replied, dryly. "You, sir, doubtless, are well mounted, and I for the present travel on foot, or on a Highland shelty, that does not help me much faster forward." So saying, he called for a reckoning for the wine, and throwing down the price of the additional bottle which he had himself introduced, rose as if to take leave of us. My companion made up to him, and taking him by the button, drew him aside into one of the windows. I could not help overhearing him pressing something I supposed his company upon the journey, which Mr. Campbell seemed to decline.
"I will pay your charges, sir," said the traveller, in a tone as if he thought the argument should bear down all opposition.
"It is quite impossible," said Campbell, somewhat contemptuously, "I have business at Rothbury. But I am in no great hurry, I can ride out of the way, and never miss a day or so for good company."
"Upon my faith, sir," said Campbell, "I cannot render you the service you seem to desiderate. I am," he added, drawing himself up haughtily, "travelling on my own private affairs, and if ye will act by my advisement, sir, ye will neither unite yourself with an absolute stranger on the road, nor communicate your line of journey to those who are asking ye no questions about it." He then extricated his button, not very ceremoniously, from the hold which detained him, and coming up to me as the company were dispersing, observed, "Your friend, sir, is too communicative, considering the nature of his trust."
"That gentleman," I replied, looking towards the traveller, "is no friend of mine, but an acquaintance whom I picked up on the road. I know neither his name nor business, and you seem to be deeper in his confidence than I am."
"I only meant," he replied hastily, "that he seems a thought rash in conferring the honour of his company on those who desire it not."
"The gentleman," replied I, "knows his own affairs best, and I should be sorry to constitute myself a judge of them in any respect." Mr. Campbell made no farther observation, but merely wished me a good journey, and the party dispersed for the evening. Next day I parted company with my timid companion, as I left the Great Northern Road to turn more westerly in the direction of Osbaldistone Manor, my uncle's seat. I cannot tell whether he felt relieved or embarrassed by my departure, considering the dubious light in which he seemed to regard me. For my own part, his tremors ceased to amuse me, and, to say the truth, I was heartily glad to get rid of him.
Chapter 5. How melts my beating heart as I behold each lovely nymph, our island's boast and pride, push on the generous steed, that sweeps along or rough, or smooth, nor heeds the steepy hill, nor falters in the extended vale below. The chase. I approached my native north, for such I esteemed it, with that enthusiasm which romantic and wild scenery inspires in the lovers of nature. No longer interrupted by the babble of my companion, I could now remark the difference which the country exhibited from that through which I had hitherto travelled. The streams now more properly deserve the name, for, instead of slumbering stagnant among reeds and willows, they brawled along beneath the shade of natural copsewood, were now hurried down declivities, and now purled more leisurely, but still in active motion, through little lonely valleys, which, opening on the road from time to time,
seemed to invite the traveler to explore their recesses. The Cheviots rose before me in frowning majesty, not, indeed, with the sublime variety of rock and cliff which characterizes mountains of the primary class, but huge, round-headed, and clothed with a dark robe of russet, gaining, by their extent and desolate appearance, an influence upon the imagination, as a desert district possessing a character of its own. The abode of my fathers, which I was now approaching, was situated in a glen, or narrow valley, which ran up among those hills. Extensive estates, which once belonged to the family of Osbaldistone, had been long dissipated by the misfortunes or misconduct of my ancestors, but enough was still attached to the old mansion, to give my uncle the title of a man of large property. This he employed, as I was given to understand by some inquiries which I made on the road, in maintaining the prodigal hospitality of a northern squire of the period, which he deemed essential to his family dignity. From the summit of an eminence I had already had a distant view of Osbaldistone Hall, a large and antiquated edifice, peeping out from a druidical grove of huge oaks, and I was directing my course towards it, as straightly and as speedily as the windings of a very indifferent road would permit, when my horse, tired as he was, pricked up his ears at the enlivening notes of a pack of hounds in full cry, cheered by the occasional bursts of a French horn, which in those days was a constant accompaniment to the chase. I made no doubt that the pack was my uncle's, and drew up my horse with the purpose of suffering the hunters to pass without notice, aware that a hunting field was not the proper scene to introduce myself to a keen sportsman, and determined when they had passed on, to proceed to the mansion house at my own pace, and there to await the return of the proprietor from his sport. I paused, therefore, on a rising ground, and, not unmoved by the sense of interest which that species of sylvan sport is so much calculated to inspire, although my mind was not at the moment very accessible to impressions of this nature, I expected with some eagerness the appearance of the huntsman. The fox, hard run, and nearly spent, first made his appearance from the copse which clothed the right-hand side of the valley. His drooping brush, his soiled appearance, and jaded trot, proclaimed his fate impending, and the carrion crow, which hovered over him, already considered poor Renard as soon to be his prey. He crossed the stream which divides the little valley, and was dragging himself up the ravine on the other side of its wild banks, when the headmost hounds, followed by the rest of the pack in full cry, burst from the coppice, followed by the huntsman and three or four riders. The dogs pursued the trace of Renard with unerring instinct, and the hunters followed with reckless haste, regardless of the broken and difficult nature of the ground. They were tall, stout young men, well mounted, and dressed in green and red, the uniform of a sporting association, formed under the auspices of old Sir Hildebrand Osbaldistone, my cousins, thought I, as they swept past me. The next reflection was, what is my reception likely to be among these worthy successors of Nimrod? And how improbable is it that I, knowing little or nothing of rural sports, shall find myself at ease, or happy, in my uncle's family? A vision that passed me interrupted these reflections. It was a young lady, the loveliness of whose very striking features was enhanced by the animation of the chase and the glow of the exercise, mounted on a beautiful horse, jet black, unless where he was flecked by spots of the snow-white foam which embossed his bridle. She wore, what was then somewhat unusual, a coat, vest, and hat, resembling those of a man, which fashion has since called a riding habit. The mode had been introduced while I was in France, and was perfectly new to me. Her long black hair streamed on the breeze, having in the hurry of the chase escaped from the ribbon which bound it. Some very broken ground, through which she guided her horse with the most admirable address and presence of mind, retarded her course, and brought her closer to me than any of the other riders had passed. I had, therefore, a full view of her uncommonly fine face and person, to which an inexpressible charm was added by the wild gaiety of the scene, and the romance of her singular dress and unexpected appearance. As she passed me, her horse made, in his impetuosity, an irregular movement, just while, coming once more upon open ground, she was again putting him to a speed. It served as an apology for me to ride close up to her, as if to her assistance. There was, however, no cause for alarm, it was not a stumble, nor a false step, and, if it had, the fair Amazon had too much self-possession to have been deranged by it. She thanked my good intentions, however, by a smile, and I felt encouraged to put my horse to the same pace, and to keep in her immediate neighborhood. The clamor of whoop, dead, dead, and the corresponding flourish of the French horn, soon announced to us that there was no more occasion for haste, since the chase was at a close. One of the young men whom we had seen approached us, waving the brush of the fox in triumph, as if to upbraid my fair companion. "I see," she replied, "I see, but make no noise about it. If Phoebe,
she said, patting the neck of the beautiful animal on which she rode, had not got among the cliffs, you would have had little cause for boasting. They met as she spoke, and I observed them both look at me, and converse a moment in an undertone, the young lady apparently pressing the sportsman to do something which he declined shyly, and with a sort of sheepish sullenness. She instantly turned her horse's head towards me, saying, "Well, well, Thorny, if you won't, I must, that's all. Sir," she continued, addressing me, "I have been endeavoring to persuade this cultivated young gentleman to make inquiry of you whether, in the course of your travels in these parts, you have heard anything of a friend of ours, one Mr. Francis Osbaldistone, who has been for some days expected at Osbaldistone Hall." I was too happy to acknowledge myself to be the party inquired after, and to express my thanks for the obliging inquiries of the young lady. "In that case, sir," she rejoined, "as my kinsman's politeness seems to be still slumbering, you will permit me, though I suppose it is highly improper, to stand mistress of ceremonies, and to present to you young Squire Thorncliffe Osbaldistone, your cousin, and Di Vernon, who is also the honour to be your accomplished cousin's poor kinswoman." There was a mixture of boldness, satire, and simplicity in the manner in which Miss Vernon pronounced these words. My knowledge of life was sufficient to enable me to take up a corresponding tone as I expressed my gratitude to her for her condescension, and my extreme pleasure at having met with them. To say the truth, the compliment was so expressed, that the lady might easily appropriate the greater share of it, for Thorncliffe seemed an arrant country bumpkin, awkward, shy, and somewhat sulky withal. He shook hands with me, however, and then intimated his intention of leaving me that he might help the huntsman and his brothers to couple up the hounds, a purpose which he rather communicated by way of information to Miss Vernon than as apology to me. "There he goes," said the young lady, following him with eyes in which disdain was admirably painted the prince of grooms and cockfighters, and blackguard horse coursers. "But there is not one of them to mend another. Have you read Markham?" said Miss Vernon. "Read whom, ma'am? I do not even remember the author's name." "Olude. On what a strand are you wrecked?" replied the young lady. "A poor forlorn and ignorant stranger, unacquainted with the very Alcoran of the savage tribe whom you are come to reside among, never to have heard of Markham, the most celebrated author on farriery. Then I fear you are equally a stranger to the more modern names of Gibson and Bartlett?"
"I am, indeed, Miss Vernon."
"And do you not blush to own it?" said Miss Vernon. "Why, we must forswear your alliance. Then, I suppose, you can neither give a ball, nor a mash, nor a horn." "I confess I trust all these matters to an ostler, or to my groom." "Incredible carelessness! And you cannot shoe a horse, or cut his mane and tail, or worm a dog, or crop his ears, or cut his dew claws, or reclaim a hawk, or give him his casting stones, or direct his diet when he is sealed, or dash. To sum up my insignificance in one word," replied I am profoundly ignorant in all these rural accomplishments."
"Then, in the name of heaven, Mr. Francis Osbaldistone, what can you do?"
"Very little to the purpose, Miss Vernon. Something, however, I can pretend to. When my groom is dressed my horse I can ride him, and when my hawk is in the field, I can fly him."
"Can you do this?" said the young lady, putting her horse to a canter.
There was a sort of rude overgrown fence across the path before us, with a gate composed of pieces of wood rough from the forest. I was about to move forward to open it, when Miss Vernon cleared the obstruction at a flying leap. I was bound in point of honor to follow, and was in a moment again at her side. "There are hopes of you yet," she said. "I was afraid you had been a very degenerate Osbaldistone. But what on earth brings you to Cub Castle? For so the neighbors have christened this hunting hall of ours. You might have stayed away, I suppose, if you would." I felt I was by this time on a very intimate footing with my beautiful apparition, and therefore replied, in a confidential undertone indeed, "My dear Miss Vernon, I might have considered it as a sacrifice to be a temporary resident in Osbaldistone Hall, the inmates being such as you describe them, but I am convinced there is one exception that will make amends for all deficiencies."
"Oh, you mean Rashleigh?" said Miss Vernon.
"Indeed I do not. I was thinking, forgive me, of some person much nearer me. I suppose it would be proper not to understand your civility? But that is not my way. I don't make a courtesy for it because I am sitting on horseback. But, seriously, I deserve your exception, for I am the only conversable being about the hall, except the old priest and Rashleigh."
"And who is Rashleigh, for heaven's sake?"
"Rashleigh is one who would fain have everyone like him for his own sake. He is Sir Hildebrand's youngest son, about your own age, but not so not well-looking, in short. But nature has given him a mouthful of common sense, and the priest has added a bushelful of learning.
He is what we call a very clever man in this country, where clever men are scarce. Bred to the church, but in no hurry to take orders.
To the Catholic Church?
The Catholic Church?
What church else?
Said the young lady. But I forgot they told me you are a heretic. Is that true, Mr. Osbaldistone?
I must not deny the charge.
And yet you have been abroad, and in Catholic countries?
For nearly 4 years.
You have seen convents?
Often, but I have not seen much in them which recommended the Catholic religion.
Are not the inhabitants happy?
Some are unquestionably so, whom either a profound sense of devotion, or an experience of the persecutions and misfortunes of the world, or a natural apathy of temper, has led into retirement. Those who have adopted a life of seclusion from sudden and overstrained enthusiasm, or in hasty resentment of some disappointment or mortification, are very miserable. The quickness of sensation soon returns, and like the wilder animals in a menagerie, they are restless under confinement, while others muse or fatten in cells of no larger dimensions than theirs.
And what, continued Miss Vernon, becomes of those victims who are condemned to a convent by the will of others? What do they resemble? Especially, what do they resemble, if they are born to enjoy a life, and feel its blessings?
They are like imprisoned singing birds, replied I, condemned to wear out their lives in confinement, which they try to beguile by the exercise of accomplishments which would have adorned society had they been left at large.
I shall be, returned Miss Vernon, that is, said she, correcting herself, I should be rather like the wild hawk, who, barred the free exercise of his soar through heaven, will dash himself to pieces against the bars of his cage. But to return to Rashleigh, said she, in a more lively tone, you will think him the pleasantest man you ever saw in your life, Mr. Osbaldistone, that is, for a week at least. If he could find out a blind mistress, never man would be so secure of conquest, but the eye breaks the spell that enchants the ear. But here we are in the court of the old hall, which looks as wild and old-fashioned as any of its inmates. There is no great toilette kept at Osbaldistone Hall, you must know, but I must take off these things, they are so unpleasantly warm, and the hat hurts my forehead, too, continued the lively girl, taking it off, and shaking down a profusion of sable ringlets, which, half laughing, half blushing, she separated with her white slender fingers, in order to clear them away from her beautiful face and piercing hazel eyes. If there was any coquetry in the action, it was well disguised by the careless indifference of her manner. I could not help saying, that, judging of the family from what I saw, I should suppose the toilette a very unnecessary care.
That's very politely said though, perhaps, I ought not to understand in what sense it was meant, replied Miss Vernon, but you will see a better apology for a little negligence when you meet the orphans you are to live amongst, whose forms no toilette could improve. But, as I said before, the old dinner bell will clang, or rather clank, in a few minutes it cracked of its own accord on the day of the landing of King Willie, and my uncle, respecting its prophetic talent, would never permit it to be mended. So do you hold my palfrey, like a duteous knight, until I send some more humble squire to relieve you of the charge. She threw me the rein as if we had been acquainted from our childhood, jumped from her saddle, tripped across the courtyard, and entered at a side door, leaving me in admiration of her beauty, and astonished with the overfrankness of her manners, which seemed the more extraordinary at a time when the dictates of politeness, flowing from the court of the Grand Monarch Louis XIV, prescribed to the fair sex an unusual severity of decorum. I was left awkwardly enough stationed in the center of the court of the old hall, mounted on one horse, and holding another in my hand. The building afforded little to interest a stranger. Had I been disposed to consider it attentively, the sides of the quadrangle were of various architecture, and with their stone-shafted latticed windows, projecting turrets, and massive architraves, resembled the inside of a convent, or of one of the older and less splendid colleges of Oxford. I called for a domestic, but was for some time totally unattended to, which was the more provoking, as I could perceive I was the object of curiosity to several servants, both male and female, from different parts of the building, who popped out their heads and withdrew them, like rabbits in a warren, before I could make a direct appeal to the attention of any individual. The return of the huntsmen and hounds relieved me from my embarrassment, and with some difficulty I got one down to relieve me of the charge of the horses, and another stupid boor to guide me to the presence of Sir Hildebrand. This service he performed with much such grace and goodwill, as a peasant who is compelled to act as guide to a hostile patrol, and in the same manner I was obliged to guard against his deserting me in the labyrinth of low-vaulted passages which conducted to Stun Hall, as he called it, where I was to be introduced to the gracious presence of my uncle. We did, however, at length reach a long vaulted room, floored with stone,
where a range of oaken tables, of a weight and size too massive ever to be moved aside, were already covered for dinner. This venerable apartment, which had witnessed the feasts of several generations of the Osbaldistone family, bore also evidence of their success in field sports. Huge antlers of deer, which might have been trophies of the hunting of Chevy Chase, were ranged around the walls, interspersed with the stuffed skins of badgers, otters, martens, and other animals of the chase. Amidst some remnants of old armor, which had, perhaps, served against the Scotch, hung the more valued weapons of Sylvan war, crossbows, guns of various device and construction, nets, fishing rods, otter spears, hunting poles, with many other singular devices, and engines for taking or killing game. A few old pictures, dimmed with smoke, and stained with March beer, hung on the walls, representing knights and ladies, honored, doubtless, and renowned in their day, those frowning fearfully from huge bushes of wig and of beard, and these looking delightfully with all their might at the roses which they brandished in their hands. I had just time to give a glance at these matters, when about 12 blue-coated servants burst into the hall with much tumult and talk, each rather employed in directing his comrades than in discharging his own duty. Some brought blocks and billets to the fire, which roared, blazed, and ascended, half in smoke, half in flame, up a huge tunnel, with an opening wide enough to accommodate a stone seat within its ample vault, and which was fronted, by way of chimney-piece, with a huge piece of heavy architecture, where the monsters of heraldry, embodied by the art of some Northumbrian chisel, grinned and ramped in red freestone, now japanned by the smoke of centuries. Others of these old-fashioned serving men bore huge smoking dishes, loaded with substantial fare, others brought in cups, flagons, bottles, yea barrels of liquor. All tramped, kicked, plunged, shouldered, and jostled, doing as little service with as much tumult as could well be imagined. At length, while the dinner was, after various efforts, in the act of being arranged upon the board, the clamor much of men and dogs, the cracking of whips, calculated for the intimidation of the latter, voices loud and high, steps which, impressed by the heavy-heeled boots of the period, clattered like those in the statue of the Festin de Pierre, announced the arrival of those for whose benefit the preparations were made. Now called Don Juan. The hubbub among the servants rather increased than diminished as this crisis approached. Some called to make haste, others to take time, some exhorted to stand out of the way, and make room for Sir Hildebrand and the young squires, some to close round the table and be in the way, some bawled to open, some to shut, a pair of folding doors which divided the hall from a sort of gallery, as I afterwards learned, or withdrawing room, fitted up with black wainscot. Open the doors were at length, and in rushed girls and men, eight dogs, the domestic chaplain, the village doctor, my six cousins, and my uncle. Chapter 6. The rude hall rocks, they come, dash the din of voices shakes the dome, dash and stalk the various forms, and, dressed in varying morion, varying vest, all march with haughty step, all proudly shake the crest. Penrose. If Sir Hildebrand Osbaldistone was in no hurry to greet his nephew, of whose arrival he must have been informed for some time, he had important avocations to allege an excuse. "Had seen thee sooner, lad," he exclaimed, after a rough shake of the hand, and a hearty welcome to Osbaldistone Hall, "but had to see the hounds kennelled first. Thou art welcome to the hall, lad. Here is thy cousin Percy, thy cousin Thorny, and thy cousin John, your cousin Dick, your cousin Wilfred, and stay, where's Rashleigh? Eh, here's Rashleigh, take thy long body aside, Thorny, and let's see thy brother a bit, your cousin Rashleigh. So, thy father has thought on the old hall, and old Sir Hildebrand at last. Better late than never, thou art welcome, lad, and there's enough. Where's my little Di? Eh, here she comes. This is my niece Di, my wife's brother's daughter, the prettiest girl in our dales, be the other who she may, and so now let's to the sirloin. Dash. To gain some idea of the person who held this language, you must suppose, my dear Tritian, a man aged about 60, in a hunting suit which had once been richly laced, but whose splendor had been tarnished by many a November and December storm. Sir Hildebrand, notwithstanding the abruptness of his present manner, had, at one period of his life, known courts and camps, had held a commission in the army which encamped on Hounslow Heath previous to the Revolution, and, recommended perhaps by his religion, had been knighted about the same period by the unfortunate and ill-advised James II. But the knight's dreams of further preferment, if he ever entertained any, had died away at the crisis which drove his patron from the throne, and since that period he had spent a sequestered life upon his native domains. Notwithstanding his rusticity, however, Sir Hildebrand retained much of the exterior of a gentleman, and appeared among his sons as the remains of a Corinthian pillar, defaced and overgrown with moss and lichen, might have looked, if contrasted with the rough unhewn masses of upright stones in Stonehenge, or any other druidical temple. The suns were, indeed, heavy unadorned blocks as the eye would desire to look upon. Tall, stout, and comely, all and each of the five eldest seemed to want alike the Promethean fire of intellect, and the exterior grace and manner, which, in the polished world, sometimes supply mental deficiency. Their most valuable moral quality seemed to be the good humor and content which was expressed in their heavy features, and their only pretense to accomplishment was their dexterity in field sports, for which alone they lived. The Strongius, and the strong Clonthus, are not less distinguished by the poet, than the strong Percival, the strong Thorncliffe, the strong John, Richard, and Wilfred Osbaldistones, were by outward appearance. But, as if to indemnify herself for a uniformity so uncommon in her productions, Dame Nature had rendered Rashleigh Osbaldistone a striking contrast in person and manner, and, as I afterwards learned, in temper and talents, not only to his brothers, but to most men whom I had hitherto met with. When Percy, Thorny, and company had respectively nodded, grinned, and presented their shoulder rather than their hand, as their father named them to their new kinsman, Rashleigh stepped forward, and welcomed me to Osbaldistone Hall, with the air and manner of a man of the world. His appearance was not in itself prepossessing. He was of low stature, whereas all his brethren seemed to be descendants of Anak, and while they were handsomely formed, Rashleigh, though strong in person, was bull-necked and cross-made, and from some early injury in his youth had an imperfection in his gait, so much resembling an absolute halt, that many allege that it formed the obstacle to his taking orders. The Church of Rome, as is well known, admitting none to the clerical profession who labors under any personal deformity. Others, however, ascribed this unsightly defect to a mere awkward habit, and contended that it did not amount to a personal disqualification from holy orders. The features of Rashleigh were such, as, having looked upon, we in vain wish to banish from our memory, to which they recur as objects of painful curiosity, although we dwell upon them with a feeling of dislike, and even of disgust. It was not the actual plainness of his face, taken separately from the meaning, which made this strong impression. His features were, indeed, irregular, but they were by no means vulgar, and his keen dark eyes, and shaggy eyebrows, redeemed his face from the charge of commonplace ugliness. But there was in these eyes an expression of ardent design, and, on provocation, a ferocity tempered by caution, which nature had made obvious to the most ordinary physiognomist, perhaps with the same intention that she has given the rattle to the poisonous snake. As if to compensate him for these disadvantages of exterior, Rashleigh Osbaldistone was possessed of a voice the most soft, mellow, and rich in its tones that I ever heard, and was at no loss for language of every sort suited to so fine an organ. His first sentence of welcome was hardly ended, ere I internally agreed with Miss Vernon, that my new kinsman would make an instant conquest of a mistress whose ears alone were to judge his cause. He was about to place himself beside me at dinner, but Miss Vernon, who, as the only female in the family, arranged all such matters according to her own pleasure, contrived that I should sit betwixt Thorncliffe and herself, and it can scarce be doubted that I favored this more advantageous arrangement. "I want to speak with you," she said, "and I have placed Honest Thorny betwixt Rashleigh and you on purpose. He will be like featherbed twixt castle wall and heavy brunt of cannon ball. While I, your earliest acquaintance in this intellectual family, ask of you how you like us all?" A very comprehensive question, Miss Vernon, considering how short while I have been at Osbaldistone Hall. Oh, the philosophy of our family lies on the surface. There are minute shades distinguishing the individuals, which require the eye of an intelligent observer, but the species, as naturalists I believe call it, may be distinguished and characterized at once. My five elder cousins, then, are I presume of pretty nearly the same character. Yes, they form a happy compound of sot, gamekeeper, bully, horse jockey, and fool, but as they say there cannot be found two leaves on the same tree exactly alike, so these happy ingredients, being mingled in somewhat various proportions in each individual, make an agreeable variety for those who like to study character. Give me a sketch, if you please, Miss Vernon. You shall have them all in a family piece. At full length the favor is too easily granted to be refused. Percy, the son and heir, has more of the sot than of the gamekeeper, bully, horse jockey, or fool. My precious Thorny is more of the bully than the sot, gamekeeper, jockey, or fool. John, who sleeps whole weeks amongst the hills, has most of the gamekeeper. The jockey is powerful with Dickon, who rides 200 miles by day and night to be bought and sold at a horse race, and the fool predominates so much over Wilfred's other qualities, that he may be termed a fool positive. A goodly collection, Miss Vernon, and the individual varieties belong to a most interesting species. But is there no room on the canvas for Sir Hildebrand? I love my uncle, was her reply. I owe him some kindness, such it was meant for at least, and I will leave you to draw his picture yourself, when you know him better. Come, thought I to myself, I am glad there is some forbearance. After all, who would have looked for such bitter satire from a creature so young, and so exquisitely beautiful? You are thinking of me, she said, bending her dark eyes on me, as if she meant to pierce through my very soul. I certainly was, I replied, with some embarrassment at the determined suddenness of the question, and then, endeavoring to give a complimentary turn to my frank avowal, how is it possible I should think of anything else, seated as I have the happiness to be? She smiled with such an expression of concentrated haughtiness as she alone could have thrown into her countenance. I must inform you at once, Mr. Osbaldistone, that compliments are entirely lost upon me. Do not, therefore, throw away your pretty sayings. They serve fine gentlemen who travel in the country, instead of the toys, beads, and bracelets, which navigators carry to propitiate the savage inhabitants of newly discovered lands. Do not exhaust your stock in trade. You will find natives in Northumberland to whom your fine things will recommend you. On me they would be utterly thrown away, for I happen to know their real value. I was silenced and confounded. You remind me at this moment, said the young lady, resuming her lively and indifferent manner, of the fairy tale, where the man finds all the money which he had carried to market suddenly changed into pieces of slate. I have cried down and ruined your whole stock of complimentary discourse by one unlucky observation. But come, never mind it, you are belied, Mr. Osbaldistone, unless you have much better conversation than these fadeurs, which every gentleman with a toupee thinks himself obliged to recite to an unfortunate girl, merely because she is dressed in silk and gauze, while he wears superfine cloth with embroidery. Your natural paces, as any of my five cousins might say, are far preferable to your complimentary amble. Endeavor to forget my unlucky sex, call me Tom Vernon, if you have a mind, but speak to me as you would to a friend and companion. You have no idea how much I shall like you. That would be a bribe indeed, returned I. Again, replied Miss Vernon, holding up her finger, I told you I would not bear the shadow of a compliment. And now, when you have pledged my uncle, who threatens you with what he calls a brimmer, I will tell you what you think of me. The bumper being pledged by me, as a dutiful nephew, and some other general intercourse of the table having taken place, the continued and businesslike clang of knives and forks, and the devotion of Cousin Thorncliffe on my right hand, and Cousin Dickon, who sate on Miss Vernon's left, to the huge quantities of meat with which they heaped their plates, made them serve as two occasional partitions, separating us from the rest of the company, and leaving us to our tête-à-tête. And now, said I, give me leave to ask you frankly, Miss Vernon, what you suppose I am thinking of you. I could tell you what I really do think, but you have interdicted praise. I do not want your assistance. I am conjurer enough to tell your thoughts without it. You need not open the casement of your bosom, I see through it. You think me a strange bold girl, half coquette, half romp, desirous of attracting attention by the freedom of her manners and loudness of her conversation, because she is ignorant of what the spectator calls the softer graces of the sex, and perhaps you think I have some particular plan of storming you into admiration. I should be sorry to shock your self-opinion, but you are never more mistaken. All the confidence I have reposed in you, I would have given as readily to your father, if I thought he could have understood me. I am in this happy family as much secluded from intelligent listeners as Sancho in the Sierra Morena, and when opportunity offers, I must speak or die. I assure you I would not have told you a word of all this curious intelligence, had I cared a pin who knew it or knew it not. It is very cruel in you, Miss Vernon, to take away all particular marks of favor from your communications, but I must receive them on your own terms. You have not included Mr. Rashleigh Osbaldistone in your domestic sketches. She shrunk, I thought, at this remark, and hastily answered, in a much lower tone, not a word of Rashleigh. His ears are so acute when his selfishness is interested, that the sounds would reach him even through the mass of Thorncliffe's person, stuffed as it is with beef, venison pasty, and pudding. Yes, I replied, but peeping past the living screen which divides us, before I put the question, I perceive that Mr. Rashleigh's chair was empty. He has left the table. I would not have you be too sure of that, Miss Vernon replied. Take my advice, and when you speak of Rashleigh, get up to the top of Otterscope Hill, where you can see for 20 miles round you in every direction. Stand on the very peak, and speak in whispers, and, after all, don't be too sure that the bird of the air will not carry the matter. Rashleigh has been my tutor for 4 years, we are mutually tired of each other, and we shall heartily rejoice at our approaching separation.
Mr. Rashleigh leaves Osbaldistone Hall, then?
Yes, in a few days, did you not know that? Your father must keep his resolutions much more secret than Sir Hildebrand.
Why, when my uncle was informed that you were to be his guest for some time, and that your father desired to have one of his hopeful sons to fill up the lucrative situation in his counting house which was vacant by your obstinacy, Mr. Francis, the good knight held a cour plenier of all his family, including the butler, housekeeper, and gamekeeper. This reverend assembly of the peers and household officers of Osbaldistone Hall was not convoked, as you may suppose, to elect your substitute, because, as Rashleigh alone possessed more arithmetic than was necessary to calculate the odds on a fighting puck, none but he could be supposed qualified for the situation. But some solemn sanction was necessary for transforming Rashleigh's destination from starving as a Catholic priest to thriving as a wealthy banker, and it was not without some reluctance that the acquiescence of the assembly was obtained to such an act of degradation. I can conceive the scruples, but how were they got over?
By the general wish, I believe, to get Rashleigh out of the house, replied Miss Vernon. Although youngest of the family, he has somehow or other got the entire management of all the others, and everyone is sensible of the subjection, though they cannot shake it off. If anyone opposes him, he is sure to rue having done so before the year goes about, and if you do him a very important service, you may rue it still more.
At that rate, answered I, smiling, I should look about me, for I have been the cause, however unintentionally, of his change of situation.
Yes, and whether he regards it as an advantage or disadvantage, he will owe you a grudge for it. But here comes cheese, radishes, and a bumper to church and king, the hint for chaplains and ladies to disappear, and I, the sole representative of womanhood at Osbaldistone Hall, retreat, as in duty bound. She vanished as she spoke, leaving me in astonishment at the mingled character of shrewdness, audacity, and frankness, which her conversation displayed. I despair conveying to you the least idea of her manner, although I have, as nearly as I can remember, imitated her language. In fact, there was a mixture of untaught simplicity, as well as native shrewdness and haughty boldness, in her manner, and all were modified and recommended by the play of the most beautiful features I had ever beheld. It is not to be thought that, however strange and uncommon I might think her liberal and unreserved communications, a young man of 22 was likely to be severely critical on a beautiful girl of 18, for not observing a proper distance towards him. On the contrary, I was equally diverted and flattered by Miss Vernon's confidence, and that notwithstanding her declaration of its being conferred on me solely because I was the first auditor who occurred, of intelligence enough to comprehend it. With the presumption of my age, certainly not diminished by my residence in France, I imagined that well-formed features, and a handsome person, both which I conceived myself to possess, were not unsuitable qualifications for the confidant of a young beauty. My vanity thus enlisted in Miss Vernon's behalf, I was far from judging her with severity, merely for a frankness which I supposed was in some degree justified by my own personal merit, and the feelings of partiality, which her beauty, and the singularity of her situation, were of themselves calculated to excite, were enhanced by my opinion of her penetration and judgment in her choice of a friend. After Miss Vernon quitted the apartment, the bottle circulated, or rather flew, around the table in unceasing revolution. My foreign education had given me a distaste to intemperance, then and yet too common a vice among my countrymen. The conversation which seasoned such orgies was as little to my taste, and if anything could render it more disgusting, it was the relationship of the company. I therefore seized a lucky opportunity, and made my escape through a side door, leading I knew not whither, rather than endure any longer the sight of father and sons practicing the same degrading intemperance, and holding the same coarse and disgusting conversation. I was pursued, of course, as I had expected, to be reclaimed by force, as a deserter from the shrine of Bacchus. When I heard the whoop and hollow, and the tramp of the heavy boots of my pursuers on the winding stair which I was descending, I plainly foresaw I should be overtaken unless I could get into the open air. I therefore threw open a casement in the staircase, which looked into an old-fashioned garden, and as the height did not exceed 6 feet, I jumped out without hesitation, and soon heard far behind the hey whoop. Stolen away. Stolen away. Of my baffled pursuers. I ran down one alley, walked fast up another, and then, conceiving myself out of all danger of pursuit, I slackened my pace into a quiet stroll, enjoying the cool air which the heat of the wine I had been obliged to swallow, as well as that of my rapid retreat, rendered doubly grateful. As I sauntered on, I found the gardener hard at his evening employment, and saluted him, as I paused to look at his work.
Good even, my friend.
Good e'en tie, answered the man, without looking up, and in a tone which at once indicated his northern extraction. Fine weather for your work, my friend. It's no that muckle to be complained of, answered the man, with that limited degree of praise which gardeners and farmers usually bestow on the very best weather. Then raising his head, as if to see who spoke to him, he touched his Scotch bonnet with an air of respect, as he observed, "Eh, gude safe us. It's a sight for Sairane, to see a gold-laced geestjecker in the Haggarden say late at e'en."
"A gold-laced what, my good friend?"
"Ooh, a geestjecker, that's a jacket like your ain, there.
They?
Perhaps from the French juste au corps. Hey, other things to do, why them up yonder unbuttoning them to make room for the beef and the bag puddings, and the claret wine? Nay doubt that's the ordinary for evening lecture on this side the border.
There's no such plenty of good cheer in your country, my good friend," I replied, "as to tempt you to sit so late at it.
Hout, sir, ye ken little about Scotland, it's no for one of good evivers the best of fish, flesh, and fowl hay we, by sibos, ingans, turnips, and other garden fruit. But we hay mense and discretion, and are moderate of our mouths, but here, fray the kitchen to the ha, it's fill and fetch mare, fray the tay end of the 4 and 20 till the t'other. Even their fast days they see a it fasting when they hay the best of sea fish fray Hartlepool and Sunderland by land carriage, for by trouts, grilses, salmon, and of the lave oat, and so they make their very fasting a kind of luxury and abomination, and then the awful masses and maddens of the pure deceived souls, but I shouldna speak about them, for your honor will be a Roman, eyes warrant, like the lave.
Not I, my friend, I was bred an English Presbyterian, or dissenter.
The right hand of fellowship to your honor, then, quoth the gardener, with as much alacrity as his hard features were capable of expressing, and, as if to show that his goodwill did not rest on words, he plucked forth a huge horn snuffbox, or mull, as he called it, and proffered a pinch with a most fraternal grin. Having accepted his courtesy, I asked him if he had been long a domestic at Osbaldistone Hall. "I have been fighting with wild beasts at Ephesus," said he, looking towards the building, "for the best part of these 4 and 20 years, as sure as my name's Andrew Fairservice." "But, my excellent friend, Andrew Fairservice, if your religion and your temperance are so much offended by Roman rituals and southern hospitality, it seems to me that you must have been putting yourself to an unnecessary penance all this while, and that you might have found a service where they eat less, and are more orthodox in their worship. I dare say it cannot be one of skill which prevented your being placed more to your satisfaction."
"It disna become me to speak to the point of my qualifications," said Andrew, looking round him with great complacency, "but nay doubt I should understand my trade of horticulture, seeing I was bred in the parish of Dreep Daily, where they raise lang kale under glass, and force the early nettles for their spring kale. And, to speak truth, I hae been flitting every term these 4 and 20 years, but when the time comes, there's aye something to saw that I would like to see sawn, or something to maw that I would like to see mon, or something to ripe that I would like to see ripen, and say I ain't diker on why the family fray years end to year's end. And I wad say for certain, that I am gone to quit at Kinnelmas, only I was just as positive on it 20 years syne, and I find myself still turning up the mules here, for a that. For by that, to tell your honour the event down truth, there's nae better place ever offered to Andrew. But if your honour wad wash me to ony place where I wad hear pure doctrine, and hay a free cow's grass, and a cot, and a yard, and mair than 10 punds of annual fee, and where there's nae laddie about the town to count the apples, I's hold mysel muckle indebted tie."
"Bravo, Andrew. I perceive you'll lose no preferment for one of asking patronage."
"I canna see what for I should," replied Andrew. "It's no a generation to wait till one's worth's discovered, I trow."
"But you are no friend, I observe, to the ladies."
"Nah, by my troth, I keep up the first gardener's quarrel to them. Their fascist bargains I crying for apricocks, pears, plums, and apples, summer and winter, without distinction of seasons, but we hae nae slices of the spare rib here, be praised for't. Except auld Martha, and she's weelin' you pleased why the freedom of the berry bush is to her sister's weans, when they come to drink tea and a holiday in the housekeeper's room, and why a wean coddling's now and then for her ain private supper.
You forget your young mistress."
"What mistress do I forget?
Wee's that?"
"Your young mistress, Miss Vernon."
"What?
The lassie Vernon? She's nae mistress o' mine, man. I wish she was her ain mistress, and I wish she mayna be some other body's mistress, or it's lang she's a wild slip that."
"Indeed," said I, more interested than I cared to own to myself, or to show to the fellow, "why, Andrew, you know all the secrets of this family."
"If I ken them, I can keep them," said Andrew. "They win to work in my wame like harm in a barrel, I's warrant ye. Mist I is, but it's neither beef nor bros o' mine. And he began to dig with a great semblance of assiduity.
What is Miss Vernon, Andrew? I am a friend of the family, and should like to know.
Other than a good aunt, I'm fearing, said Andrew, closing one eye hard, and shaking his head with a grave and mysterious look. Something glad your honor understands me?
I cannot say I do, said I, Andrew, but I should like to hear you explain yourself, and therewithal I slipped a crown piece into Andrew's horn hard hand. The touch of the silver made him grin a ghastly smile, as he nodded slowly, and thrust it into his breeches pocket, and then, like a man who well understood that there was value to be returned, stood up, and rested his arms on his spade, with his features composed into the most important gravity, as for some serious communication.
Ye maun ken, then, young gentleman, since it imports you to know, that Miss Vernon is dash. Here breaking off, he sucked in both his cheeks, till his lantern jaws and long chin assumed the appearance of a pair of nutcrackers, winked hard once more, frowned, shook his head, and seemed to think his physiognomy had completed the information which his tongue had not fully told.
Good God! Said I, so young, so beautiful, so early lost.
Troth ye may say she's in a manner lost, body and soul, for be being a papist, eyes upon her for and his northern caution prevailed, and he was again silent.
For what, sir? Said I sternly. I insist on knowing the plain meaning of all this.
On, just for the bitterest Jacobite in the Haleshire.
Pshaw! A Jacobite? Is that all?
Andrew looked at me with some astonishment, at hearing his information treated so lightly, and then muttering, "Aweel, it's the verst thing I ken aboot the lassie, howsoe'er," he resumed his spade, like the king of the Vandals, in Marmontel's late novel.
Chapter 7. Bardolph. The sheriff, with a monstrous watch, is at the door. Henry IV. First part. I found out with some difficulty the apartment which was destined for my accommodation, and having secured myself the necessary goodwill and attention from my uncle's domestics, by using the means they were most capable of comprehending, I secluded myself there for the remainder of the evening, conjecturing, from the fair way in which I had left my new relatives, as well as from the distant noise which continued to echo from the Stone Hall, as their banqueting room was called, that they were not likely to be fitting company for a sober man. What could my father mean by sending me to be an inmate in this strange family? Was my first and most natural reflection. My uncle, it was plain, received me as one who was to make some stay with him, and his rude hospitality rendered him as indifferent as King Hal to the number of those who fed at his cost. But it was plain my presence or absence would be of as little importance in his eyes as that of one of his blue-coated serving men. My cousins were mere cubs, in whose company I might, if I liked it, unlearn whatever decent manners, or elegant accomplishments, I had acquired, but where I could attain no information beyond what regarded worming dogs, rowling horses, and following foxes. I could only imagine one reason, which was probably the true one. My father considered the life which was led at Osbaldistone Hall as the natural and inevitable pursuits of all country gentlemen, and he was desirous, by giving me an opportunity of seeing that with which he knew I should be disgusted, to reconcile me, if possible, to take an active share in his own business. In the meantime, he would take Rashleigh Osbaldistone into the counting house. But he had 100 modes of providing for him, and that advantageously, whenever he chose to get rid of him. So that, although I did feel a certain qualm of conscience at having been the means of introducing Rashleigh, being such as he was described by Miss Vernon, into my father's business, perhaps into his confidence, I subdued it by the reflection that my father was complete master of his own affairs, a man not to be imposed upon, or influenced by anyone, and that all I knew to the young gentleman's prejudice was through the medium of a singular and giddy girl, whose communications were made with an injudicious frankness, which might warrant me in supposing her conclusions had been hastily or inaccurately formed. Then my mind naturally turned to Miss Vernon herself, her extreme beauty, her very peculiar situation, relying solely upon her reflections, and her own spirit, for guidance and protection, and her whole character offering that variety and spirit which piques our curiosity, and engages our attention in spite of ourselves. I had sense enough to consider the neighborhood of this singular young lady, and the chance of our being thrown into very close and frequent intercourse, as adding to the dangers, while it relieved the dullness, of Osbaldistone Hall. But I could not, with the fullest exertion of my prudence, prevail upon myself to regret excessively this new and particular hazard to which I was to be exposed. This scruple I also settled as young men settle most difficulties of the kind. I would be very cautious, always on my guard, consider Miss Vernon rather as a companion than an intimate, and all would do well enough. With these reflections I fell asleep, Miss Vernon, of course, forming the last subject of my contemplation. Whether I dreamed of her or not,
I cannot satisfy you, for I was tired and slept soundly. But she was the first person I thought of in the morning, when waked at dawn by the cheerful notes of the hunting horn. To start up, and direct my horse to be saddled, was my first movement, and in a few minutes I was in the courtyard, where men, dogs, and horses, were in full preparation. My uncle, who, perhaps, was not entitled to expect a very alert sportsman in his nephew, bred as he had been in foreign parts, seemed rather surprised to see me, and I thought his morning salutation wanted something of the hearty and hospitable tone which distinguished his first welcome. "Art there, lad? Eh, youth's irate but look to thistle, mind the old song, lad. He that gallops his horse on Blackstone Edge may chance to catch a fall." I believe there are few young men, and those very sturdy moralists, who would not rather be taxed with some moral peccadillo than with one of knowledge and horsemanship. As I was by no means deficient either in skill or courage, I resented my uncle's insinuation accordingly, and assured him he would find me up with the hounds. "I doubt na, lad," was his reply, "thou'rt a rank rider, eyes warrant thee, but take heed. Thy father sent thee here to me to be bitted, and I doubt I must ride thee on the curb, or we'll hae someone to ride thee on the halter, if I take now the better heed." As this speech was totally unintelligible to me as, besides, it did not seem to be delivered for my use, or benefit, but was spoken as it were aside, and as if expressing aloud something which was passing through the mind of my much-honored uncle, I concluded it must either refer to my desertion of the bottle on the preceding evening, or that my uncle's morning hours being a little discomposed by the revels of the night before, his temper had suffered in proportion. I only made the passing reflection, that if he played the ungracious landlord, I would remain the shorter while his guest, and then hastened to salute Miss Vernon, who advanced cordially to meet me. Some show of greeting also passed between my cousins and me, but as I saw them maliciously bent upon criticizing my dress and accoutrements, from the cap to the stirrup irons, and sneering at whatever had a new or foreign appearance, I exempted myself from the task of paying them much attention, and assuming, in requital of their grins and whispers, an air of the utmost indifference and contempt, I attached myself to Miss Vernon, as the only person in the party whom I could regard as a suitable companion. By her side, therefore, we sallied forth to the destined cover, which was a dingle or copse on the side of an extensive common. As we rode thither, I observed to Diana, that I did not see my cousin Rashleigh in the field, to which she replied, "Oh no, he's a mighty hunter, but it's after the fashion of Nimrod, and his game is man." The dogs now brushed into the cover, with the appropriate encouragement from the hunters all was business, bustle, and activity. My cousins were soon too much interested in the business of the morning to take any further notice of me, unless that I overheard Dickon the horse jockey whisper to Wilfred the fool, "Look thou, and our French cousin be not off a first burst." To which Wilfred answered, "Like a now, for he has a queer outlandish binding on's caster." Thorncliff, however, who in his rude way seemed not absolutely insensible to the beauty of his kinswoman, appeared determined to keep us company more closely than his brothers, perhaps to watch what passed betwixt Miss Vernon and me, perhaps to enjoy my expected mishaps in the chase. In the last particular he was disappointed. After beating in vain for the greater part of the morning, a fox was at length found.